UNHCR reps who are here with us today to make a presentation on their role, on how they deal with the issue of refugees in the region. Okay. There are apologies from other members. Those who will be joining us will find us along the way as we move on with our business for today. Like we have said, honourable members, that today's meeting is about the role of the UNHCR in the region. And today we have Mr. Kibimbi, who is leading the delegation. I think it would be proper if we introduce ourselves first, and then in turn they will introduce themselves also to us. My name is Maggie Mawunye, a member of the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs.
Morning everyone, thank you Chairperson. My name is Sarah Peterson Madonna, a member of the Portfolio Committee of Home Affairs.
Good morning all, my name is Annette Lasmore, also a member of the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs.
Good morning, my name is Masizole Masela, member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Andre Gauma, member of the committee.
I'm Graham McIntosh, a member of the committee.
Thank you, honourable members.
Thank you. I'm Sanda Kibimbi. I'm the regional representative for Southern Africa for UNHCR.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Kalma Male. I'm the head of office for the field office for UNHCR in Cape Town.
Good morning. My name is Chely. I'm Chely Dion. I'm the associate settlement officer at the UNHCR Cape Town. Thanks.
Good morning, my name is Adam Simon. I do research for the committee.
Morning, Eddie Matonzi, committee secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Kibimbi. I'm sure we're in your hands now. Mr. Kibimbi has requested that he be given about 45 minutes to do the presentation so that he can expand on what he wants to say, and then after that it will be time for questions. Over to you, Mr. Kibimbi.
Thank you. At the outset, I would like to thank you, Madam Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, and the honorable members who are here for affording me this opportunity to address you. At UNHCR, we value very much interacting with members of parliament who are the representatives of the people, who are on the ground and know what the issues are. We value this opportunity to provide you with an international perspective on this very important issue of refugees and forced displacement. And we believe that having that international perspective would probably help you as you embark on your very important tasks of acting as an oversight body on the work of government in general. In today's world, obviously, one cannot ignore the international dimension of issues, particularly when it comes to population movement. People move across the borders, not just one border, several borders, and therefore, looking at the issues from the international angle is extremely important. So what I intend to do in the next 45 minutes is just to go very quickly through some of the various points and issues that we deal with at UNHCR, providing you with some information on the magnitude of the refugee problems and others which are somehow related, the basic principles which govern our work, and also the kind of interaction that we do have with government. Then later on, I hope that we can discuss also some of the issues which are most relevant to you here in South Africa, some of the issues that we have been dealing with, discussing with our government counterparts, our colleagues from the civil society, and so forth. and then I hope that we would have time perhaps to interact and have a discussion on the various points. Now, I prepared a PowerPoint presentation. I believe a copy has been given to you. I think that would facilitate our going through some of the issues. The presentation is basically around six issues, which is UNHCR and the whole idea, concept of international protection, who are the people who are concerned to the organization, the global trends, which is essentially the figures, what is the magnitude of the problem, the legal framework which govern our work, the statistics, and then also the activities of UNHCR in South Africa. Now, I was able to bring some documents which I believe have been given to you, and I do hope that you will have time to take certain time from your busy schedule to at least skim through them at your leisure. UNHCR is an international organization. It's part of the United Nations, created in 1950, began its work in 1951, the 1st of January. We operate on the basis of a statute, which is basically a charter, which was adopted by the General Assembly of the United Nations. We are to work under the supervision of the ECOSOC, which is the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. So our High Commissioner reports on a yearly basis on its activities to that body. The organization, as we speak today, has about 6,500 people working in over 120 countries. As we will go, you will see later on when you look at the figures of displacement, you will certainly immediately understand where we are present. The mandate of the High Commissioner is of an apolitical nature, apolitical, non-political nature. That is extremely important, because often, the issues that we deal with do have a political character. Obviously, conflict, wars, and so forth, do have certainly at the roots, politics and economic, social crises, and so forth. So we have to guard from adopting a political line, and our mandate is very clear. Our mandate is of a social and humanitarian nature, and we do not involve ourselves in politics. Now, obviously, we are often caught up with the politics, as you can imagine, but as an organization, we certainly cannot be taking a political stand on the issue. The organization is headed by a High Commissioner who is elected by the General Assembly, and that is something which is important to refer. He is actually the only head of the UN agency who is actually elected by the General Assembly of the United Nations. The other, the Director General of UNICEF, for example, of WFP and so forth, are appointed by the Secretary General. In our case, the Secretary General makes a recommendation to the General Assembly, and it is the Assembly who actually elects the High Commissioner. That, I think, is something we always highlight, because it gives him a standing, which is entirely very, extremely important as he goes about fulfilling his mandate. Now, a very important body that exists and which then directly supervises the work of the UNHCR is the Executive Committee. That is a committee made of 85 countries, which meets annually. It's a committee which approves our program, our budget, and then also provides guidance on international protection. It's a committee which meets, as I say, once a year, but there are standing committees attached to that which meet three, four, five times every year, reviewing different issues and then providing guidance to the office as to how to go about tackling problems as they come about. We will see later on the legal framework for this work on refugees, the 51 Convention, the protocol, and so forth. Now, as you can imagine, these are international legal instruments which are adopted at a given time. But then in the meantime, things evolve. There are issues which arise and which certainly were not dealt with within by the convention. So it is important to be able to adjust, to adopt some basic principles as you go along to govern issues. Let me give you a very, very concrete example of what the Executive Committee did in the past and the kind of conclusions that it adopted. you know, during the apartheid days, we had problems in the 70s of the apartheid regime bombing places like Botswana, and Angola, Mozambique, and so forth. So at one stage, it became a very, very serious issue to be dealt with. In 1981, for example, the committee spent time discussing this whole issue of the militarization of refugee camps and the attacks on the refugee camps, adopting conclusions, recommending states how to deal with these kind of issues of attacks on refugee camps, which had been occurring, so often. So the conclusions, I gave a copy to the chairperson earlier on, and if you look at the conclusions that were adopted at the time, you see the relevance of them. The same way, for example, we had in the 80s also, end of the 70s and early 80s, the boat people movement from Vietnam. So there was need to come up with some principles as to how to deal with people who are caught up at sea. The whole question of rescue at sea, what do you do with large-scale movement of people, issues which were not necessarily tackled very directly and clearly in the convention. So through the executive committee of UNHCR and its work on international protection, we are able to develop some very basic principles as to how to deal with matters. And it covered the whole range of issues about, as I said, large-scale movement of people, issues of detention, of family reunification, and so forth. I find it probably the most useful document in my work, I must say, because it's very straightforward. The language is very clear, which is not always the case with some of the legal instruments and conventions and so forth, and it's certainly very up-to-date because it's very useful. So I would definitely encourage you to take a look at those conclusions as exercise your mandate. The protection mandate of UNHCR is the most important one. I mean, we do have a mandate which calls upon us to protect, together with others, of uprooted people, and to seek and find permanent solutions to their problems. The mandate, as far as the coverage is concerned, has been expanding. Because if at the beginning, in 1951, we were to deal primarily or only, I would say, with refugees, in other words, people fleeing conflict and persecution, over the past few years, that mandate has extended, where today we do not only deal with refugees, but also with asylum seekers, so people before they are recognized as refugees, and we deal also with stateless people. And this is something which is very important. Among the documents that has been given to you, there's one on the issue of statelessness, and I hope we'll have the chance later on to talk a little bit about the issue of statelessness in this region. We also work with internally displaced people, in other words, people who are forced to move but remain within the limits of their territory. And that's also a mandate that we exercise, not alone, together with other UN agencies and generally speaking with the all civil society movement and, of course, with government. And then finally, we also deal with returnees. In other words, when people have ceased to be refugees and returned home, we also exercise our mandate with regard to that category of people. So it is clearly a broad range of people that we have to deal with. But this being said, the primary focus still remains refugees. In other words, we are clear that if our mandate with regard to refugees is to be compromised because of our involvement with the other groups, we would put our mandate for refugees first. Now, obviously, we try to find a balance and to exercise a mandate in its fullest, with all the components, but at the end of the day, the refugees remain the core of the activities of the office. Now, the whole question of responsibility to protect people, as you very well know, is a very current one, and it's talked about quite a lot. And in that regard, I think I have to highlight the fact that states are primarily responsible for the provision of international protection to refugees. Because after all, states ratify the various conventions. States undertake to do a certain number of things by signing and ratifying those international instruments, and then states do have, of course, the means to exercise a number of responsibilities within the territory. UNHCR works closely with government, of course, to ensure that that responsibility is fulfilled. But one thing we must systematically repeat is that we are not a substitute for government responsibility. At the end of the day, it is the government of the land which must take action to protect people. After all, UNHCR does not have a police force. We do not have, you know, an army. We do not have a judiciary system. It is the state which has got all this. And these are the instruments, of course, of protection of the individual who find themselves in the territory. I would like to really mention that, and because, you see, in the past, there have been some confusion in that regard and some misunderstanding, which have led some people, genuinely, I mean, not really by bad faith or whatever, but genuinely think that, you know, there could be instances where UNHCR would stand up and say, we are taking action, and the state should just, you know, be set aside and go. 2008, we had these very unfortunate events in the country, you know, of attacks against foreigners and foreign, you know, nationals and so forth, right? A number of people were claiming that government was not acting forcefully enough, was not taking action fast enough, was not doing the right thing and so forth, and that somebody else had to act. UNHCR had to come in and then basically mount a response on the issue. And I was at pains to say that this is not our role. Yes, we are here to advise government, if advice is taken, to capacitate government within, you know, the means at our disposal, but at the end of the day, it is up to the government to act. Okay. And in fact, I remember receiving a letter for Mrs. Sandra Botta on the issue, and I had to respond and again draw her attention to the fact that, you know, the role of the organization is one of supporting the state and not of substituting itself to the organs of the state. And I think that is very important today, with all the issues that we have to deal with, which have been recurrent. You know, our role is not to substitute ourselves for government, not here, not, or anywhere else, let's face it. The persons of concern to UNHCR, we are very familiar with these issues, these concepts, so I won't really dwell too much on that. You know, refugees, the definition is clear. These are people who are either fleeing persecution on several grounds, which are clearly spelled out both in the international instruments and then when they are domesticated, you know, in the legislation. So these are people fleeing, you know, persecution because of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, membership of a particular social group. In the case of South Africa, there is one which has a category which has been added, which is a tribe, which I would say is just a clarification, but tribe could also probably fall under the concept of nationality. Nationality not being citizenship, by the way. Nationality is more ethnicity than anything else. So that's one aspect of the definition. The second one, of course, is under the OU Convention, which applies to the continent. You know, there is also a refugee, a person, you know, who has been forced to flee his or her country because that country has been has undergone a foreign aggression. There has been an act of aggression or foreign domination, occupation, or when there have been events seriously disturbing public order in that country. That is a concept which is very important, and I hope we will revert to it later on when we discuss the issue of Zimbabwe, because there have been calls, you know, from many places, you know, people, that the situation in Zimbabwe, particularly in 2008, had to be described as one where there were events seriously disturbing public order, and therefore Zimbabweans in South Africa had to be recognized as refugees under that convention of the OAU. We disputed that. UNHCR did not take that line, so but we can perhaps discuss it later. So this is for refugees, asylum seekers. These are, of course, people who, you know, believe, claim to meet the criteria for recognition as refugees, but then they have not yet gone through the whole process of being determined as such. Stateless persons, that's also obvious, people who do not have the benefit of a citizenship, of a nationality. As I said, a very important issue, emerging issue, but one that probably will retain our attention in the years ahead. Internally displaced people, these are people who are basically running away or leaving their homes for the same reasons than refugees, but they are not crossing an international border. They are remaining within the borders of their own countries. And then, of course, obviously, they remain under the jurisdiction of the state of the country. That is a very important. It's an issue which also has evolved quite a lot of late, but mark you, it was difficult to get states to agree that there has to be some international intervention or intervention by others than themselves when dealing with internally displaced people. The whole concept of sovereignty was constantly brought to the fore, where states would say, listen, these are our own people, they are within our territory, what business do you have to come and talk about their protection? We are the one who protect our own people. It's none of your business to come and start telling us what to do and so forth. So things have evolved quite a lot of late, and I think today there's an acceptance that indeed, even though the sovereign character of the state is maintained and no one disputes that, there is also room for an intervention from others, you know, starting with humanitarian agencies and protection agencies. And this has been very much reaffirmed within the African Union, where in 2009 the continent adopted a convention on the protection and assistance of internally displaced people, which clearly reaffirmed that principle that it is, you know, legitimate for others to intervene in the issue. It's a convention, I'll mention it later on, perhaps, which still needs to be ratified by South Africa, so if the note could be taken of that, to be very, very good. So far, there are 7 countries which have ratified. There are 7 others whom we understand have actually agreed to the ratification, have done all the formalities, but have not yet deposited the instrument. And therefore, once they have done that, we will have 14. And we need 15 members for the document, the convention to enter into force. If South Africa could be the 15th, but it would be good because that would, you know, kick in the entry into force of the convention. And then finally, returnees. Returnees, these are people who are refugees and then, you know, conditions in their country have changed and they return home. Now, the global trends, now, just to give you an indication of the magnitude of this refugee problem, this is also something that I'm sure you have heard about. Every year we do publish some statistics which I think they are as close as possible to the reality, that one would not venture and say that they are necessarily, you know, correct I mean, in terms of exact numbers, but it gives, I think, a very good indication of the magnitude of the problem. And as you can see, refugees, 9.9 million worldwide, 2.3 million in Africa. We are doing better than in the past. You know, in the early 90s, we were described as the continent of refugees with about 5 million refugees. That, you remember, was the period when we had this crisis in Rwanda, the genocide, which had led to a huge displacement of people. We also had a problem in Liberia, we had a problem in Sierra Leone. We were at about 5 million refugees, you know, in the early 90s. So the figure has gone down by half, which means the solutions have been found, you know, on a political level, you know, where agreements are signed and peace has returned to many places. And of course, when peace returns, you know, people do go back home. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not new crises. Somalia is a good example now, where the number has been increasing instead of, you know, going down. But by and large, I would say the number of refugees has decreased, particularly in the African continent. The number of asylum seekers is still is there. I mean, I'll say a few words on asylum seekers later on, particularly as it relates to South Africa. The statelessness figure is the most difficult one to apprehend, because as you see, worldwide we are talking about 3.5 million, but the statistic that you see in this global report at the first page, you see that we are putting a higher figure of 12 million people. That is the estimate for us of the number of stateless people worldwide. However, we had to rely on figures given to us by states, which is much, much lower. I think it's a function of two things. First of all, ignorance of the issue, or unwillingness to recognize the issue as such, and just the fact that, you know, no one has really so far paid sufficient attention to that problem. And then it's also difficult to get collect data on people who are statelessness and often are off the radar. Okay. So the figure that we put here is really what we got from the States, 21,000 in Africa, but there are many, many more people in this continent who are stateless. In other words, who are unable to produce a document ascertaining their citizenship, are unable to take part in voting, benefit from all the services that nationals are entitled to. Internally displaced, that I think is an interesting figure, 14.6 worldwide, 6.2, and that has always been the case. This is something that people often forgot. Whenever we have a crisis anywhere, you have more people who are displaced internally than those who actually cross international borders. More people remain within the limit. They won't stay in their homes or the areas of origin. They will move, but they will move within the territory. Crossing an international border is always a very important decision that people take, and they don't take it lightly. Often it is really just because they are forced to cross international borders that they would do so. If they can remain within the country, their country of origin, they would do so. And then returnees also, about 200,000 worldwide. This is also a very disappointing figure for 2010. In the past, we have been having many, many more people returning home, in the context of voluntary repatriation. So I would say 2010 was not a good year in that regard. So the statistics at a glance that I would let you look at it at your leisure. As you can see, worldwide, the continent with the highest number of refugees is Asia, with the Afghan crisis, which after years is still one, which is resulting in people being out in primarily in Pakistan and in Iran. Africa comes second with 24%, and then Europe. A continent which has done quite well is Latin America. As you well know, Latin America in the 70s and even a bit early 80s has suffered all these crises of coup d'etat, Pinochet, and it's a continent which I think has done quite well in solving its problems, with a clear improvement in terms of the rule of law and democracy and so forth. And that clearly gets reflected in the numbers of people who run away from those countries. So it's a very, very small number. In fact, Latin America, the biggest problem faced for them is really one again of internal displacement in Colombia, where, as you know, there are problems of conflict, which is being solved somehow, but that still has led to major insurgency, which has led to major internal displacement. The figure for Europe is also one that one has to look at carefully. It is not just people who arrive on their own and have been arriving recently. It also encompasses, of course, people who got resettled to Europe, from different countries. And then, of course, it's explained also by the Balkan crisis, which has led to quite a number of people leaving the conflict of Bosnia and so forth, although quite a number of them return home. But the figure is relatively still high. Now, if we focus on Africa, we are fortunate in Southern Africa, where we have, after all, only 7% of the refugees recognize. Of course, the big problem, the area for problem area is, as you can imagine, the Great Lakes region with DRC, and then the Horn of Africa with the influx of Somali into Kenya. So 40%, and if you take the Horn of Africa, Eastern Horn of Africa, that is Kenya, Somali refugees in Kenya, and in Ethiopia, to a certain extent in Djibouti. You take the Sudanese refugees from Darfur and into Chad, and then you take the Great Lakes, in the Great Lakes, the Congolese refugees in Tanzania and in other places, Burundi and so forth. That really constitutes the biggest number of refugees in the continent. Now, when you look at refugee-producing countries, that's also an interesting element. As I indicated earlier, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia for Africa, 770,000. The number increases every day. DRC, Nyama, Colombia. Colombia, that's the figure of refugees. They're not displaced. The internally displaced are 2 million, but these are Colombians who moved out of Colombia primarily to Ecuador. Vietnam is also an interesting figure. These are essentially people from the Vietnam conflict, you know, who happen to still be in China as refugees. And then Eritrea, which is producing quite a number of refugees today. Now, individual applications, here that's where I really need to qualify something. As you see, South Africa is the country which has got the highest number of individual applications. This is something that we always need to explain. It doesn't mean that this is the country which received the highest number of refugees or asylum seekers. It received the highest number of individual applications, because when the Somalis leave Somalia and go to Kenya, the cases are not reviewed on a case-by-case basis, one by one, individually. What happens is that the Kenyan government has made a determination that all the Somalis who arrive as a result of the conflict in Somalia are recognized as refugees ipso facto, prima facie, as we say. They do not go through an individual determination. And then, of course, you know, we're talking about thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who benefited from that. However, here what we are talking about are countries which determine refugee status for on a case-by-case basis, where an individual has to apply for status and the application is to be reviewed by the body which has been set up to review those applications. In our case here, as you know, the Department of Home Affairs plays that role. So when you look at individual applications, South Africa is number one. That figure also, and I hope we'll have the chance to discuss that a little bit, to me, to be very frank, it is a bit artificially high. It is artificially high because when you look at the 2010 figure of 180,000, there are about 140,000 applications which are from Zimbabweans. Now, the situation of Zimbabwe in South Africa, to me, has always been something which, I must say, exemplifies perhaps the difficulties of coordinating things between us, UNHCR, and the government. In the sense that we believe that many of these 140,000 applicants, asylum seekers of Zimbabwe, probably did not have the intention to apply for asylum in this country. They must have come for all sorts of reasons. However, there was no document other than the asylum seeker's permit which could be given to them. And as I said, let us perhaps, you know, revisit that matter later on and go into the detail of what happened in 2008 when the then Minister of Home Affairs, Mrs. Rapisa Nakulam, you know, in a decision that we definitely approved and applauded, you know, decided that there was going to be a stay of deportation of Zimbabweans. That there would be an automatic visa, 3 month visa issued to Zimbabwe who would enter with the right to work, and that the department would issue a special permit to Zimbabwe under the Immigration Act. So we all thought that what was going to happen was that Zimbabweans were going to be given a permit under Article 31(2)(b) of the Immigration Act, which gives, as you know, the power to the minister to give the right of a permanent resident, the rights. It doesn't say to give permanent residency, but the rights of permanent resident to a person or to a group of persons if there are some special circumstances which warrant that. Now, as an office, we had been for long, together with civil society organizations, advocating for that special regime, temporary regime for Zimbabweans, given what was happening in 2008 and also the crisis of 2009, the economic meltdown and the cholera crisis and so forth. So we all thought that when the minister on the 1st of April 2008 announced that decision, that immediately thereafter we were going to be told that the Zimbabweans would be given a special permit, temporary permit, 1 year, 2 years, no matter, but a special permit under the Immigration Act. That did not happen. But rather, the department started issuing asylum seekers permits to individuals. And of course, when you start giving asylum seekers permits, there are a number of rights which kick in. In other words, the claim has to be reviewed, and then if the claim is negative, there's an appeal process. And that is what has made our figures of asylum seekers in South Africa extremely high. Because, although it's not here, when you look at the figures before 2008, we were talking about 50,000 asylum seekers a year in South Africa. Yeah. We were not talking about 100,000, over 100,000 people applying for asylum in the country. Yeah. In fact, when I take the statistics of the department itself, I could see that, let me just go quickly, in 1998, these were the old days, 11,135. Let's jump to 2001, 16,325 asylum seekers. 2005, 43,289. 2006, 53,381. 2007, 45,637. 2008, 207,000. 2009, 341,000. You see, so I think we can perhaps revisit that issue of the large number of asylum applications in South Africa, which probably could have been, you know, kept at a reasonable level if there had been the decision, you know, to issue a special temporary permit as opposed to directing people into the asylum regime, in the asylum system. And by the way, giving temporary asylum or temporary protection to people is not something which is unusual. It happens everywhere. The United States, year in, year out, you know, has this system of providing people with what they call TPS, you know, temporary status, you know, temporary protection status. You know, they give it to when countries are at war, for example, and they do not necessarily want to embark on this individual review of applications. They will take a group and just say, okay, Salvadorian, for example, TPS. In other words, for 1 year, you have a protection in place, and it will be reviewed after a year. If things have changed, the situation has changed, it will be revisited. Otherwise, it gets prolonged, extended. So it's something that we had discussed, and we had hoped, frankly, that we could have achieved something different than what was finally implemented in South Africa. All right. The legal framework now, I think, again, is something that you are quite familiar with, the different legal instruments which govern this issue of refugees, the 51 Convention, the Protocol, the OEU Convention, the importance, of course, of domestic legislation here also, and here South Africa has got, of course, its 1998 Refugee Act, which was amended this year. The issue of statelessness is also governed by international conventions, you know, both at the level, universal level, and at the regional level. The internally displaced issue, I mentioned the African Union Convention on the Protection and Assistance of Internally Displaced People, and with the hope that you could use your influence to have the process of ratification initiated in South Africa. Not that we believe South Africa would have internal displacement problems, but it is just being part of this whole community, international community, trying to address the issue in a predictable way. This is really what these conventions do. They provide us with a framework, within which issues are dealt with, in a calm and moderate way, without passion, because you know what is written black and white and how you will go about addressing the problem. And then the returnees also, that is governed primarily by the OAU Convention. That's an important disposition, provision of the convention, which calls on states, countries of origin, country of return, and UNHCR to negotiate these agreements which should lead to people returning home when the conditions allow. And one of the principles, of course, enshrined there is that when people return, they should not be victimized. Okay? And then all assistance should be given to them to reintegrate society, obtain the documents, that they deserve, the identity papers, and so forth, and then also certainly the assistance that they can expect. And all these are often framed within tripartite agreements that are signed by the countries of origin, of asylum, and UNHCR. Now, the legal framework of South Africa, truth. I don't need to tell you what it is. You are all very familiar with that, the Constitution, the Refugee Act, the Immigration Act, which is, of course, relevant in that regard, as was seen this year when you amended the provision regarding the asylum transit permit, reducing the number of days to five within which a person must apply. And here, what I would like to add are the, within, as part of this legal framework, are the court cases, you know, which we sometimes overlook. I think civil society and some legal organizations play a very important role, which I think is healthy, you know, of bringing cases to the courts, you know, to test, basically, you know, some of these legal provisions and the constitutionality of some measures and so forth. That is extremely important, you know, and that has got to be encouraged, as far as, you know, I'm concerned, because that's what makes, you know, basically a place, a country where, you know, rule of law is respected. You know, Parliament adopts legislation, sure, there's a constitution, but now and then the administration, the government takes measures which may not necessarily be in line with what has been adopted. So having the court system review that and give some direction and interpretation, it's good, without, of course, usurping your power as a lawmaker. Ultimately, you are the one who makes the law. But I think it helps in interpreting some of those provisions. And here, you know, I'm mentioning that because there are two cases, for example, which are extremely important in South Africa, you know, that people should know about. The Wachenuka case, for example, which was decided in 2004 by the Supreme Court of Appeal, and which basically recognized the right to work and to study, you know, to asylum seekers. Yeah. That was through a court decision. Now, I won't go into the details, you know, we can discuss one day the interpretation that has been given, but the fact of the matter is that after that case, the Department of Home Affairs, you know, recognized the right for asylum seekers, not refugees. Refugees, their right to work and study is already in the Act itself. But when it comes to asylum seekers, it was through a court case. And the same way, the Tafira case, for example, was also an important one, you know, regarding the procedure that the Department of Home Affairs has been applying when reviewing asylum applications, you know, receiving people and so forth. So the role of the court system, you know, the judiciary, in advancing the rights of the individuals and so forth is quite important and useful. Now, the South African legal regime, we do consider it to be a progressive asylum regime. This is UNHCR views, and we will repeat it. No matter what is being said, on the paper, it is clearly an excellent and progressive regime which adheres to international standards. There are procedural safeguards, rights and obligations, and so forth, for refugees, right, that they're clearly defined. Now, the problem, of course, of the legal framework in South Africa is implementation, where, as we all know, there are challenges, and but as far as the framework is concerned, it is clearly there, it is in place, and one has to applaud the country for having adopted such a progressive legal regime. And I do hope that the amendments that you are bringing in will not result, you know, in a reversal of these very positive provisions and so forth. So that's really a call that I would like, you know, to make. And we just again reiterate that, you know, we are available to discuss and provide the international perspective, you know, the international dimension of some of the issues, if it could help you as you review some of those legislation. Now, I'm saying that because the slide here that I put, which I'm sure you are very familiar with as well, may in fact constitute the menu, you know, for the changes that will be occurring in the next few years to deal with this very, very serious challenge that the country is confronted with, of huge number of applicants and an asylum system which, let's face it, is defective. You know, I don't think anyone really would dare say that the system as it is being implemented, you know, meets the needs of anybody, certainly not of the genuine refugees. And I think at the highest level in government, I mean, the minister has said it herself, the predecessor has said it, and, you know, everyone acknowledges that there's need to reform the asylum system. That reforming the system does, should not lead to a lowering of standards and certainly the violation of some of the basic internationally recognized principles. So the policy review in South Africa, as you know, it's premised, I would say, also by the fact that we have a large mixed migration phenomenon. In other words, people moving into the country for a variety of reasons. some, of course, for refugee-related reasons, persecution, violence, and so forth, but also others for economic reasons. So the challenge there is to separate who is a migrant, you know, who is a refugee. In that regard, I have circulated to you the document called the 10-point plan, which I would encourage you to read. This is a document that was produced by UNHCR, which sets out the problem and gives some suggestion as to how, you know, this issue of protecting refugees within the context of mixed migration could take place. You know, it calls for cooperation, obviously, between the different states involved. It calls for the need to obtain proper data, you know, about the nature of the movement, the need to establish, and here I'm going to be careful using that word because I know it's part of the talk here, reception centers, you know, to deal with the matter. I mean, it's more complex than one would think about, but certainly all these are contained in the 10-point plan, you know, that we have come up with, the need to establish proper refugee status determination systems, which are, you know, fast, where you can clearly determine who is a refugee, who is not a refugee. And it also acknowledges the fact that not everyone deserves protection under the refugee regime. And then if a person is not recognized as a refugee, the person falls under the immigration law, an immigration act, obviously with some basic rights as migrants, because migrants also have rights. But it is still the right of the state to decide what to do with a migrant who is illegally or irregularly in the territory. And if it leads to a decision to deport, that has to take place. And again, some conditions with all the guarantees, the constitutional guarantees that entail. I mean, we all know deportation is not just a decision that can be taken, you know, arbitrarily, and people are out there. There are guarantees, legal guarantees, which must be, you know, followed, and conditions of return and so forth must be, you know, respected, where human dignity and so forth clearly are still. But the 10-point plan, I think, spells out very clearly all those issues, and I would definitely encourage you to take a look at that. We are promoting that document as the basis of our dialogue with government. Now, the challenges, as I said, mixed migration, the question of access to the territory, you know, they are access to the asylum system. Territory is all question of, you know, do you screen people at the border or not? You can discuss that. Accessing the asylum system, the challenges of that we know here with the old reception centers, which are overburdened and sometimes have to close as a result of court action. The old question of return to safe third country or first country of asylum. That issue, unfortunately, systems are such as that, I understand, you have a limit in the number of pages, the size of documents that can be forwarded. Because yesterday, in preparation for this meeting, we asked a friend here, the secretary, to circulate a 111-page piece, article, you know, which was written by an academic, a professor at Washington University, the title being Secondary Refugee Movement and the Return of Asylum Seekers to Third Country, the Meaning of Effective Protection. So what I will be doing when we finish the meeting is to give the link, the website, the link, so that it could be shared with you. And I also have a hard copy, which I can make available for those of you who would like to have it reproduced. Now, the fact that you have a study like this, which has got 111 pages, to me indicates that the issue is not as straightforward and simple as one would think, because there are a number of considerations that one has to look at when you go into this issue of returning people to a safe third country or using the country of the first country of asylum. We can also discuss that perhaps later on, but it's an issue. It's on the table, and it cannot be avoided. The issue of relocating the refugee reception offices close to the border, I think you will have to debate that at some stage. We have some views, you know, on that ourselves. The question of reception arrangements, reception centers, and, you know, I mean, these are issues which are complex. They are complex because, you know, as much as you would like to put together systems, you know, you have to keep in mind that you are dealing with human beings. Human beings do have their aspirations, and you know, that cannot be ignored. And at the end of the story, you also have also basic principles which systems. systematically and constantly must be upheld about human dignity, about, you know, the need not to violate people's basic rights. But I think all these issues, frankly, can be worked. One can work out many of these issues, you know, by properly studying your legal framework, your setup, also looking at what others have been doing, because this is one of the features of today's world, you know, this question of population movement. It is not only South Africa which is confronted with the problem. There are so many countries which are facing the same kind of challenges, the same kind of problems. So knowing what the others are doing is always very useful and can inform you certainly as you determine your own policies, because after all, you do determine your own policies, but learning from others may be helpful. The question of the right to work and study for asylum seekers, we understand this is an issue which may be revisited. You know, we hear that there might be some legislation suggested to Parliament to deny asylum seekers the right, you know, to work and study. A right which, as I indicated earlier, was granted to them not through legislation, but through a court case. So these, I think, are some of the policy issues that probably will be looked at. Statistics in South Africa, again, refugees, the number of recognized, so those who are carrying a refugee permit, it's about 57,899. These are figures from the department, by the way. Asylum seekers, you have it there. The nationalities that we know, Somalia, DRC, Ethiopia, and then asylum seekers from Zimbabwe, of course, 81%. Malawi, Ethiopia, others. That's where we have problems. Malawi, frankly, normally we should not be really having that many Malawian asylum seekers. Yeah, we know what has happened in Malawi over the past few months, so you may have here and there some, but I mean, not in the numbers that we have. Here on the statistics, if I may also appeal on you, if you could, you know, use the influence you have on the department, you know, to renew efforts for compiling statistics and issuing them on time. It is very difficult to have those statistics. And sometimes when they come, you doubt really the genuineness or, you know, the quality of the information that is being provided. Without proper statistics, it's extremely difficult to plan, you know, and to even discuss issues. We have offered our support to the department, and we have reiterated it time and again that if they need assistance, you know, we are there. We had our statistician who traveled from Geneva a few months ago, had meetings with the department, and but we still have not really moved sufficiently in that regard. So here, perhaps, as the oversight body, if you could impress on them on the need to have proper statistics to inform the debate. The activities of UNHCR in South Africa, we, of course, work with government. Every week, every month, there's a meeting between some of my colleagues, particularly those in protection, with the chief director of asylum management of the department. We also have, of course, discussions at a higher level, highest level, whenever it is needed. We do work with civil society as well, obviously. We have what we call protection working group, which meets regularly, where we coordinate our positions, our advocacy line. You know, advocacy, of course, is extremely important in this work. I mean, being able to advocate for changes, for certain decisions, for certain policies, I think is part also of the work of any international organization and civil society in general. And what we expect, of course, is receptiveness. Not necessarily that everything that we advocate for would be adopted. At the end of the day, government governs. But I mean, having a receptive government is very important. Government which listens, who takes into account advocacy messages and lines and so forth, and considers them in good faith. I think this is what we do expect. We provide some training as well. To government officials, that's something activity on a regular basis. The RSDO, those people who are doing eligibility, now are going to be replaced by the committee, understand, or the compliance officer, the registration officers. We did more, I would say, in 2009. 2010 and 11, I would say, We wish we had had more sessions, but what we were being told is that the Department of Home Affairs is in fact setting up a training academy, and this is what they would like to have, all those trainings now being channeled through the academy. So we do hope to be able to establish a good rapport with the academy and contribute to its work by providing experts who can come and address issues and train the officers and so forth. On emergency response, also issue of camp coordination, that is something that we handle, that we deal with the disaster management. I mean, what happened in 2008, of course, taught us some lessons. The first one being the need to work very closely with the disaster management, both at the national and at in the provincial, even municipal level. The need for the disaster management center to be properly knowledgeable about, these issues of displacement and what to do if there is indeed a massive population displacement. Do you automatically set up safety camps or sites like was done here? Aren't there alternatives? And you set up the safety sites. Aren't there things that you have to look at to make sure that the assistance that you provide there is not questioned and so forth? So there we also are very close contact with disaster management and train and discuss with them. And then finally, we do provide also, that is something which is not necessarily known, to individual and vulnerable refugees and asylum seekers, where about legal advice, about emergency assistance, skills training, and so forth. And that we do through our colleagues, our implementing partners. Now, I put a table here also to just give you an idea, I think, the sake of transparency, just so that you should get the figures of the kind of arrangement that we have with some organization in the country and the amount of money that we contribute to them, like the Jesuit Refugee Service, for example, or the Cape Town Refugee Center, with which we have an agreement to the tune of 6.1 million rand, where they provide food assistance to vulnerable refugees, they provide shelter support when the kids are unable to access educational facilities, they accompany them and try to obtain this waiver of fees, and then language training, all sorts of things. Now, we wish we had more money, of course, but we are trying our best with the different partners that you can see there, and today we are really talking about 32 million rand support, and we also have a small component that we use directly ourselves for that kind of support. And I'm going to finish on this presentation by just talking a little bit about the durable solutions, which, as you know, are low voluntary repatriation. When conditions allow, people should be going back home. I would say in the case of South Africa, we are not very, very successful in that regard. Very few people, once they arrive in the country and are recognized as refugees, are willing to return home for reasons that you can understand. I mean, they have made links, they have established themselves in the country, some have married, South Africans, others are doing quite okay economically. And then, of course, you have to look also at the overall economic situation of this country compared often to their country of origin. But what is striking is that very few refugees, once recognized in South Africa, would go home. Rather, what they would like to do is to change their status from that of a refugee to a permanent resident, which, as you know, is a possibility under the Act, provided you have stayed for 5 years and that some conditions have been met. So that's why we only repatriated during this period, 2009, 2011, 311 people, which is really a very, very small number. We do encourage people, of course, to consider repatriation, voluntary repatriation, but I would say we are not very successful. Local integration is obviously the key concept as far as South Africa is concerned when it comes to durable solutions. This is a country which, and it has got to be commended for that, has made it very clear that it would like to see refugees live alongside nationals and integrate into society and not live in ghettos and what have you. So that is obviously very important. The old idea of local integration, which of course has been possible because of the very positive stand taken by the country when ratifying the 1951 Convention, when it did not enter a reservation to Article 26, which is a freedom of movement provision, many countries did make a reservation and say that they do not want to be bound by that provision. South Africa, to its credit, did not, and said clearly that it will respect that provision and allow free movement to people. They can settle wherever they want and they can move freely. That is extremely important. And we are, in fact, recommending to all the countries in the region to follow suit and adopt the same position than South Africa. So that facilitates, obviously, local integration of people. One area I would like to mention here, again, to maybe call on your support, is the whole question of grants. I know it doesn't really fall with your portfolio. It's more the portfolio committee of DSD, chaired by Mrs. Botha, whom I met, in fact, not long ago. But I think we believe that as much as possible, if the grants, if refugees qualify for grants, if they can be afforded that. I mean, right now, as we speak, again, through court decision, I believe, refugees are able to obtain a disability grant and a foster child grant through court action. But there are, I think it would be good if consideration could be given to allowing refugees to have the child grant, for example, and also in case of really emergency, social relief for distress grant. So these will be measures which will be in line with the whole policy of local integration. Obviously, under this concept of local integration, a number of people manage on their own. And by and large, I would say refugees in South Africa do manage. That's the reality, which is not perhaps sufficiently highlighted or underlined. They do manage. But then you have also some who are indeed vulnerable, are in need of support, and if they could obtain that support from the state, it would be very good. And then lastly, that's the solution we have, resettlement, which, as you know, is a process whereby a person, refugee, who would have been recognized in South Africa will be taken from this country to another country, provided that latter country accepts the person. And these are usually the Western countries, Canada, Australia, US, and so forth. Now, we do submit cases for resettlement only when we feel that the person's security is really in danger. Like now, for example, as you see the figure we have during this period of January 2009 and October 2011, submitted 2,408. The majority of them, the majority are Somali nationals, people who have been victims of attacks on several occasions. And we just feel that they have to be given a break somehow. So we do submit their cases. The number of people who departed during that period is 516, which is low, which I think just shows one thing, is that submitting an application is one thing, having it accepted is another one, because after all, states decide whether they would accept or not. And I refer to the Somalis, for example. We are submitting them, but of late, we are experiencing tremendous difficulty with the United States of America, which basically said that it doesn't want to take Somalis anymore because of security considerations. So they have a very, very tight and strict security screening, which is in fact resulting in the Somali applicants not being accepted in the U.S. anymore. So, but it remains a solution for some people. And we have been saying all along also that it is not the solution for the majority of the people. And this was, for those of you who followed the issue in 2008, one of our big, big problems, convincing or trying to explain to refugees, to civil society as well, that we could not, in 2008, just mobilize planes and take people on the plane and fly them out wherever they wanted to go. It just doesn't work like that. You have to submit applications. It takes time, on average 2 years, for an application to go through. There are procedures for emergency applications that we have with some countries, essentially Scandinavian countries, before very, very compelling cases which they would then review within a few weeks. But that's really exceptional. But on average, the normal application would take a couple of years, and without guarantee of success. I think I will stop here, but before doing so, let me just mention the word, since I did not really refer to it as it deserved, the old question of link to local integration, the old question of xenophobia. attacks on foreigners and so forth. It is indeed a very, very serious problem, you know, which indeed it's not as serious or dramatic that it, than it was in 2008. We all remember those unfortunate events. But as we speak today, we still have too many incidents involving, you know, foreign nationals, particularly Somali nationals, you know, being attacked and so forth. Now, is something being done about it? Definitely. I mean, we can recall that the police has been much more active, you know, over the past 18 months or so. We have, for example, a direct line of communication with a senior official at the police, that is General Chipu, who is based in Pretoria, and he is the head of the community policing, whom we contact night and day. We can call him at 1 o'clock in the morning, at 2 o'clock in the morning, relay information about an attack or threat which is happening, and I must say action is being taken. So this is something that we do want to put on the record, you know, the greater involvement of the police. But that's not enough. You need, as you know, a lot of things in terms of prevention and reaction and so forth. And here, and I will finish and on that, what we have been really advocating, if there could be a kind of coordinating body, a central organ, you know, be it at deputy president office or wherever, which could put all these initiatives, you know, and the ideas around the issue of anti-xenophobia campaign together, so that you have a central body which is clearly at the state level, which is clearly seen as driving the effort, you know, to address the issue and the first instance, of course, mitigate the consequence of this xenophobia issue. Again, it's not just a South Africa issue, it's, you know, worldwide. There are many places where the problem arises, but reflecting upon it and having a central organ will probably help in advancing on a very important issue. I think I will stop here, and thank you for your attention, and perhaps you can have some discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kibimbi, for your elaborative information. I'm sure we'll take questions from the members. The routine here is that we take more than 3-5 questions and then you note and then respond after that. Honorable members, I notice Honorable Peterson Maduna, Honorable Lovemore, Honorable Marcella, Honorable McIntosh in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you again for the presentation you just gave me. My first question, I just want to know, you spoke about the executive committee. I just want to know, is it being monitored? If it does, how often? And then my second question, in the case of a mass influx of refugees into South Africa, what contingency plans, if any, does UN have in place to deal with such a situation? And then my third question, what more can be done over and above the documentation of Zimbabwean's project, since so many economic migrants did block up the asylum seeker process? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for what was really a fascinating presentation. As always, I have a number of questions, and I'll be as brief as possible. With respect to xenophobia, there is a national action plan, I'm told, from the Joint Interministerial Committee chaired by the Minister of Police. Have you had sight of the national action plan? And are you happy with it? I don't know whether you'd answer that. And specifically in light of a report I read recently was by the South African Migration Project on xenophobia in South Africa, showing South Africans to be amongst the most xenophobic in the world. Another report on xenophobia, I think it was SAHRC, indicated or gave a recommendation that municipalities must have social cohesion as part of the integrated development plans. Now, municipalities ordinarily do not have any record of the number of refugees or asylum seekers entering their boundaries, their municipal boundaries. And I am told by the Minister of Cooperative Governance that they certainly do not have social cohesion as part of their integrated development plans. Is this something which concerns you and in which you are involved, or are you only working at national government level? Your involvement in the future refugee management policies that you mentioned, won't you just expand on that? How involved are you? Are you being consulted on a regular basis and at an intimate level? You spoke about the mixed migratory system, and we all know that is a problem. I was told by Helen Ziller last week that the West Cape is currently receiving in the order of 1,000 Somalians a week. It is an unsustainable situation. We have to realize that. Now, I'm interested in your 10-point plan, so I don't expect you to elaborate on that. We will obviously read that. But Somalia is an interesting case where we have political turmoil, but also the famine. Now, you spoke about events seriously disturbing public order. Is the famine considered as an event seriously disturbing public order, and would those people then be considered as refugees or as part of the economic migrant system? Very quickly, what are your views? In fact, you made reference to the relocation of the refugee reception offices closer to the border, and you said, I won't say any more on that. I'd love to hear what your views actually are. Why do you express the hope that new legislation, the new Refugees Amendment Act and also the Immigration Amendment Act, you express the hope that the new legislation will not reverse the gains that have been made? In other words, you have doubts. Why did you express that hope? And then just lastly, Chairperson, it's very disturbing that you say that you've done less training of RSDOs than you have in the past, over the last 2 years. Every refugee reception centre that I have visited, when I ask about training of RSDOs, they always tell me UNHCR does the training. We don't do the training. The Learning Academy is not up to that, is not doing the training of the RSDOs. So it's very, very disturbing. Won't you just expand on that as well, what training you are doing at this stage, whether you have any concerns about the training of RSDOs with respect to country information, etc.? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the UNHCR for the very good presentation, as always. My question is more of a comment, the first one. That perhaps we need to do more of an interaction and awareness on the 1951 convention. Because what I've picked up as I go around, I do more interaction with civil groups and those pressure groups that are involved with working in the communities. When we interact with them, most of the time we'll find that there's very little understanding of what it is that South Africa has actually ratified. And I think also among members in general, we need to try and harness that kind of understanding of the convention. Otherwise, if you look at MPs, and we are public reps, so we work in communities where all these things that we talk about to take place. For instance, with the xenophobic attacks in 2008, most people were saying, these people are taking our wives, they're taking our girlfriends, they're taking our jobs, our houses, and all these things. So had there been enough understanding on the ground, like the campaigns of HIV and AIDS and others, where people know that if you don't use a condom, you'll contract HIV, and if you don't have one partner, the next thing that is going to happen, you have more risk. So what is it that UNHCR is doing in trying to ensure that more work is done on the ground on the awareness and on prevention of such kind of hostilities that one may find in the communities. And then, basically, the question has been raised somehow, but let me just go back to it, perhaps obliquely. I would like to understand, if you move people from South Africa to a third country, what is the intention of that, and whether or not you see that as the solution to whatever the kind of challenge that is faced by refugees or any other formation or any other persons in that space. The other one, Chair, what are the reasons for? I mean, what are the UNHCR impression on the security in North Africa, and of course, what are the implications of that? If you look at the North Africa situation, and obviously the kind of influence that may have in our situation here in South Africa, and in fact in the SADC, that's probably the last one for now, Chair. Thank you very much.
Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that presentation. I do have perhaps the...
Can you use the mic?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I do have one or two questions on the matter, because it does, and maybe, and please excuse me if I'm ignorant, but it seems to me as though the UNHCR in South Africa is almost a little government within the government, which I'm not sure is that the UN mandate. But we have very considerable technology. Are you equipped to do fingerprinting, to keep proper records? Do you keep some sort of record? Today, with modern technology, that's becoming increasingly viable. And if you did do that, would you make that information available to our Department of Home Affairs and the South African Police Services? Do you do surveys, in other words, market surveys, I mean, they're called focus groups or something, because obviously most refugees aren't going to tell you the truth easily, but they might tell you the truth. Because they have some confidence in you. Why are these people here? What are they doing? But you did say very disarmingly that most people in South Africa are surviving quite well. I mean, the people who are coming into the country. And certainly that's the South Africans' impression. People come from outside of the country. Most of them are economic refugees, although I notice you don't have a category for that. And they come to this country, and when they arrive, they don't see a lot of unemployment and poverty-stricken people. They actually just see opportunities, or where they make opportunities, whether they go Somalis trading or Congolese people. And then whether you mentioned Mozambicans, do you not regard them as from another state? You also talk about you must respect the sovereign character of states. Do you ever try to approach the states which are sending these refugees? I mean, do you engage with them? Because we, for example, with the Zimbabweans and Mozambicans, are carrying huge financial costs in terms of education, maternity. We also have very large numbers of students. I mean, if you go to in the Western Cape, you'll find huge numbers of Kenyans studying in our tertiary institutions. Now, I'm not suggesting they're refugees, and maybe I don't understand the subtleties of the difference. But then I just have another question. Is some of the people that you're giving money to in your list, I mean, I can understand the Messina Legal Advice Office on the border. I can also understand your... giving money to a church like El Shaddai, which is giving food assistance in Messina. But what I don't quite understand, and why do you feel that you don't think it's interference in South Africa's domestic affairs to fund the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan, to fund the human rights organizations, etc., Lawyers for Human Rights, because in a sense... they are advocacy groups who should, in a sense, be able to source their own funding. And why do you feel it's necessary for you to fund them? Thank you.
You may respond to Mr. Kibembe.
Okay, thank you very much to all of you for your questions and remarks. So I'll try to respond and comment on some of them as much as and as best as I can. Now, the Honourable Peterson Maduna, you mentioned about, you talked about the Executive Committee and asked if it was monitored. The Executive Committee basically works under the aegis of the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. Okay, so you know, the way the UN operates, you have the General Assembly, and then you have different councils. One, the one relevant for us is the Economic and Social Council, and then below that you have the Executive Committee. Now, it is a committee which is made of member states. You know, there are 85 members there, but which are states, basically. So there is no control over that body. It's an independent body. It is an independent body made of states, and it acts quite independently. It submits a report, you know, to the Economic and Social Council, like many organs, you know, social and humanitarian organization and organs do. But there's no control as such, which is a basic principle of international law. You know, when you have bodies which are made of states, they basically call the shots and they decide on their course of action. And it is not really a problem. I mean, the committee's work is to exercise oversight and support over UNHCR as an organization. So what is important really is that that function is carried out, and it is being carried out. Okay. So the number, of course, varies also. We are 85 today. Every year, I mean, if any country which would like to join is able to do so by submitting an application, and then it will be reviewed by the Economic and Social Council, which will make a decision, and usually it is accepted. The only thing which is expected is that you are dealing with a country which is respectful of refugee law in general and humanitarian principles, and which is active and has been, you know, doing some good work with relation to these issues of refugees and displacement and so forth. South Africa, of course, is a member of that committee. Now, if there was to be a mass influx in South Africa, do we have a contingency plan? That's an important question. That's an important question which I must say we debated ad nauseum in 2009, you know, when, as you remember, you know, we had that crisis in Zimbabwe. I mean, post-election of 2008, you know, the results came in, and then we had, you know, the cholera, and then the economic meltdown, and so forth. So on that occasion, obviously, a decision was made to prepare contingency plans for a possible outflow of refugees from Zimbabwe to the neighboring countries. Okay, I'm going to be very candid. South Africa was reluctant to embark in that exercise. Whereas in a place like Zambia, the office was able to actually sit down with the officials and clearly discuss, you know, possible points of entry, you know, reception arrangements which could be made, prepositioning of items, you know, and whatever. There are some countries which were not keen on discussing that matter. South Africa was one of them, and Mozambique was the other one. Zambia had no problem. Botswana had no problem. Okay. That's the reality. That's where we get caught up with politics. Because clearly the line that the government here took was that there was not going to be a mass influx. That there was an initiative taken in 2008, as you know, led by former President Mbeki, who was a facilitator of the discussions and so forth, and to go and this was more or less, it was not said in so many words, but I mean, this is what we gathered. Where the head of state was facilitating a mediation process to achieve a political solution, it was felt that you could not at the same time envisage a failure of that mediation and a displacement of people. That's basically, I think, was the bottom line. That you could not. It was a contradictory. On the one hand, to have a process led by the head of state, and the other hand, start planning for an influx, because that would have implied a failure of the whole thing. So I would say there was not much cooperation. It's really at the 11th hour, I would say, that the department was then prepared to talk about it. Because there was at some stage, you know, when the violence really increased and the situation became really untenable, that we started talking with the department. They agreed to talk about the contingency plan, and a site was identified, you know, in Musina, where perhaps people could be, you know, housed in case of an influx. And I mean, we did invest a lot, I must say. We had missions, I don't know how many missions. We had a mission of our physical planner, we had the mission of our team people, we had missions from our registration people from Geneva and so forth, just trying to engage government and discuss in that matter. As I said, ultimately there was a little bit of discussion, but it was not really that earnest. That's okay. As we speak today, we do not have a plan. I can tell you. We have an indication ourselves as an organization, some ideas as what would happen. We have items which we have been keeping since 2008 in Durban. We brought in some tents, we have some blankets, we have some mats, you know, and then jerry cans and so forth, which we brought in 2008, you know, as we 2008-2009, as we were planning these things, and we still have them there. Okay. So on our side, we have some idea of what could happen, but we cannot go far without government cooperation, because obviously, you know, we are not the one who are going to be deciding, you know, first of all, under what conditions and what arrangements people will be able to enter, you know, what kind of documents they will be issued, where they will be assisted, if assistance will be given, are they going to be allowed to just, you know, enter the country on their own, will they be kept somewhere for a period? These are discussions that can only take place with government. And I would say here right now, there's no contingency plan. This being said, what I understand, and I stand to be corrected, with the system in South Africa is that if we had an influx here, I mean, the Disaster Management Act would kick in. So if a determination is made, the Disaster Management Act would be the legal instrument on the basis of which action would be taken, with then the involvement of the National Disaster Management, the center, and all its satellite organizations and so forth. That's how I believe the matter would be ended here. It would be a declaration of disaster, you know, and then obviously it would be the Disaster Management Center would play a key role there with funding from the state. That's why, as I indicated when making the presentation, I told you that we do keep in close contact with the Disaster Management Center, you know, on not preparing specific for an influx with a clear plan, but certainly with regard to training, exchanging information, and having the assessment of the possibility or risk of an influx and so forth. So, but that would probably would be the response. And we would then cooperate with the Disaster Management Center, and not just UNHCR. I mean, there would also be other UN organizations who certainly would come in, like UNICEF with its mandate for children. There would be, you know, probably UNFPA for issues of linked to population registration movement and all the like, UNDP. I mean, the UN system would be involved. It would be a UN system response in support to government. But we would again expect government to take the lead, particularly in a country like South Africa with its elaborate system in place. It operates differently elsewhere. I mean, if we have an influx tomorrow in Liberia, like we had, for example, at the end of last year of Ivorians, you know, people from Cote d'Ivoire, you know, moving into Liberia, that's different. There, UNHCR basically led the response. The UNHCR was in the driving seat in receiving people and so forth, with the agreement, of course, of the government. Okay. But that is because it's Liberia, which does not have the capacity, you know, and the system that exists here in South Africa. But it's a very important point. And frankly, among my objectives, that of, you know, the the office for next year, it is one of my key objectives to achieve, to work on a contingency plan, because, well, let's face it, 2012 or 13, there will be elections in Zimbabwe, and there will be the risk, again, of, you know, God forbid, but there is a risk of, again, having some turmoil and problems which may result in population displacement, internally and externally. So contingency plan is key. It's needed. What more could be done with regard to the documentation of Zimbabwe? Well, I think the whole Zimbabwe documentation project, we are on the record of saying it, excellent initiative, and we applaud the government for having embarked on it. Now, we will wait to see the assessment that will be made, because I do not remember attending this presentation from the general to you in September, where it was announced that the final report will be given to the minister. I hope there will be some information as to what that report says, the lessons that have been learned. But again, I think it's an excellent initiative. We are not a migration agency here in Asia, although we do take interest in migration issues. In other words, no, we are not there to necessarily be in the driving seat or in the front line on the issue of migration. We are not. We are a refugee agency. No, we are about internal, forced displacement, as opposed to the voluntary movement and migration and so forth. This being said, we advocate for as many rights as possible to be recognized to migrants, because we believe that it sets the scene, it creates an environment which is conducive to the protection of those people who are forced to flee persecution and war. Because obviously, if you have an environment where migrants' rights are respected, migrants are documented and so forth, the likelihood of having them trying to go into the asylum system, you know, is less. The likelihood of them somehow disrupting, you know, the running of the asylum system by huge number of applications and so forth is lower. So everybody has got to gain in having a proper migration system, well managed and so forth, because you benefit when even when your particular primary interest is refugees. So that's why we did welcome, of course, and we did advocate for this Zimbabwe project, and we do hope that on the basis of the results that will come, perhaps there will be a decision to extend it. I do not know, because of course some people have been saying that the number of people who were able to regularize their stay was relatively low as compared to, you know, the need that those would have done it. So if that is the conclusion, I don't know if a decision is done, is made to renew the exercise, we would certainly recommend that. I think for the Zimbabwe, this project, frankly, I think what was, I don't know if it was overlooked, but certainly not, there was not sufficient attention paid to the whole issue of the passport to be issued by the Zimbabwe government. That, frankly, I mean, we did draw attention to that, you know, in our discussion with the department. It is clear that by putting the whole system somehow, having it inch on the production of a Zimbabwe passport, was going to create problems, because everybody knew that that people would have difficulties accessing that passport. And this is what actually happened. Now, was it possible to come up with something different? In other words, would it be possible for South Africa to issue the permit without a foreign national producing a passport? I don't know. Maybe something could have been thought about. Maybe they should have come to you in Parliament and suggest something, so as to avoid making the success of the exercise pretty much depending on the action of a foreign country, if you understand what I mean here. Because I think that was the major hurdle for people, was to obtain the Zimbabwe passport, so as to regularize the state. If something else had been put in place, probably many more people would have been able to benefit. So yes, let's hope it happens. Let's see the results, the lessons that I learned. But one thing is clear: it seems that many more people would have wished to benefit. And we do hope that that kind of exercise is repeated. I mean, we talk about Zimbabwe, if it could be also for other nationalities, you know, why not? That, I understand, was the intention. The minister, I think, had announced that they would, you know, she would start with Zimbabwe, but then subsequently some other nationalities may also be included in similar exercises. Now, my hope, of course, is that before this is extended to other nationalities, there is a proper review of what happened with the Zimbabwe project, so as to, you know, to draw the lessons and make sure that, you know, next time around, one is satisfied that everything has been done to cover as many people as possible. But again, as an initiative, certainly to be loaded, and because it helps us in dealing with the refugee matters. The more Zimbabweans go in through this migration route and get regularized, the less the number of them would use the asylum system and clog it, as is happening now. Can Honorable Love more, okay, your xenophobia, I'm not aware of the plan. It has been drawn up at the ministerial level under Minister Ntetwa. Minister Ntetwa, I must say, is very cooperative. Let me put it like that. We were extremely happy, you know, as the UN system, when he took the trouble, I must say, to visit us last year in the UN building, okay, just close to, you know, after the World Cup, where there were talk of renewed attack and so forth. We did, through the resident coordinator, contact him, and he came, and he had, you know, we spent 2 good hours in a very relaxed and open meeting where all the issues, the discussions took place. This is somebody that we find to be very receptive and certainly prepared to listen. And as I indicated in the presentation, we believe that the action of the police is quite commendable. If there is one organ which has been really doing a lot over the past 18 months or so, it is the police, which is much more reactive, you know, to incidents and so forth. Now, that doesn't mean everything is perfect. You still hope to see more forceful action in terms of prevention and then also at the judiciary, you know, criminal justice, judicial system should perhaps be more active. But the police certainly, as far as we are concerned, is doing its very best. Now, we understand the limitations, the challenges, and so forth. But I'm not aware of the inter-ministerial plan. I'm just going to say it as it is. Therefore, was not consulted, of course. The report about South Africa being the most xenophobic, I frankly would not go for that. I'll be very honest. I mean, these are, to me, statements that may be headline catching, but I mean, these are not the kind of things that we at UNHCR say or endorse. Okay. Now, xenophobia is a phenomenon. It's a worldwide phenomenon. I'm sure there have been people in Ukraine, in Russia today, you know, take the view that their country is, you know, is the most xenophobic. So we certainly do not go along those lines. So I will not comment. As I said, it's a worldwide phenomenon. It takes place in South Africa as well, and all we can hope for is indeed the action is being taken, you know, to address it, looking into all the various elements. So the social cohesion at the municipality, yes, I think at the municipality level that action should be taking place, obviously. Again, I'm not aware of any particular initiative, you know, being taken there. All I know is that what we ourselves are doing, the little effort that we are making, you know, around this issue of xenophobia, we do have. In the past, there was a huge campaign in the late 90s, which was pretty much spearheaded by the Human Rights Commission, together with UNHCR. Usual kind of campaign that you can imagine, sensitizing the community and so forth. So what we are doing now, in our small way, frankly, is that, you know, we use the limited means that we have on some campaigns, you know, radio, we did produce some radio, soft, what do you call them, opera type things, clips, you know, which were in local languages, and they were distributed to various radio stations throughout the country with calls for the radio station to broadcast them. You know, we do organize some sporting events here and there to draw attention to the issue. I mean, these are the usual standard things that organizations do, and we don't do it alone. I mean, I know civil society also does have those initiatives. It is important, but it is not enough. And as I alluded to earlier on in the presentation, we need to have a strong action led by government. That's really the only way this issue would put and remain on the front burner, and with a chance of, in the first instance, mitigating the consequences, and then ultimately perhaps, you know, solving it altogether. I don't think want it to be unrealistic. It will always remain there, but it may take a different form and, you know, than what it is today. Because today the drama, the dramatic thing is the violence which accompanies those incidents, you know, particularly affecting Somali. People die, I mean, every month. We have 7-10 people who are losing their lives. And that is really something quite unacceptable. So there are several organizations which do take initiatives here and there, but having it coordinated, having it really spearheaded by, you know, government would be certainly an important thing. Are we consulted regarding the reform? That's, again, one of those difficult questions, in the sense that it is not a process, you know, whereby once the department has something in mind, where they would automatically come to us and say, you know, this is what we would like to do, what do you think about it? It doesn't work like that. In some countries, it works like that. In others, it does not. So South Africa, I would say, is in the categories of countries where UNHCR is not systematically or consulted as a matter of course. Should that happen, that's another question. I mean, I can fully, and we would like, of course, to be consulted. But when a government does not consult us, I mean, who are we to go and demand? We certainly do not demand. Okay. The only basis, I would say, for us to request, you know, some interaction is that when you take the convention, the 1951 convention, Article 35, okay, calls for cooperation between UNHCR and the contracting parties, the states which have ratified the document. And then we do have some kind of supervisory role, you know, to over the way the convention is implemented by states. Okay. So on that basis, of course, we have an entry point for dialogue, for requesting information, you know, and discussing and so forth. Right. But, you know, international law, as you know, is a rather interesting system where, at the end of the day, you don't impose. You don't impose anything on a state which does not want, you know, to do something. The only thing you would do if you feel uncomfortable or you're upset is to condemn, to go public, you know, and what have you, which we try to avoid because we always try to maintain this dialogue and communication and so forth, because we believe that this is the way you produce that result. So on the reform, I would say I did have the chance to discuss the various aspects of the reform a few months ago with Mr. McKay when he was still the Deputy Director General. Okay. We had a discussion exchange where I shared with him, you know, the views of the organization on some of the policy, you know, review that you saw taken place. There is a on a monthly basis, I think I indicated earlier, interaction between my deputy, you know, who deals with protection matters, and some of my colleagues, together with the chief director of the department, the one dealing with asylum management. There is this protection working group, which is an informal group with NGOs, you know, other UN agencies, and sometimes the department sends a representative to the discussion. So there is interaction, there is dialogue, you know, we express our views and so forth, but you cannot describe it as a structured consultation process. It is not. Whether it should be or not, for me, I think it should, and I would very much welcome that, and we are definitely prepared, you know, to put all our efforts and to have that structured discussion, because we think that it would be important. It would lead, you know, to some positive outcome, starting with probably, if not a guarantee, but at least in the sense of making sure that whatever is being discussed and reformed and so forth is in line with international practice and international principles and so forth. That's really, mixed migration. Yeah, 10,000 Somalis a week in Western Cape. 1,000, sorry, yeah. Mixed. Now, the Somali situation is quite difficult to I mean, it's a special one. I mean, the Somali, because as you know, yes, Somalis come from far away. Many of them reach South Africa, having transited through Kenya, Tanzania, Mozambique, and so forth, which does not necessarily put them under a good light when you review their cases, or you basically see the group and why they're coming and so forth. On the other hand, we very well know what is happening in Somalia. I would say their status as refugees cannot be questioned. They are refugees, there's no doubt about it. Why aren't they staying, you know, in the different countries at the transit? There could be, you know, reasons, understandable reasons. I mean, you take a place like Kenya, which is the first country where most of them end up. I mean, first of all, there's an encampment policy. They have to go to the camp, the Dadaab camp, which was built for 90,000 people. It has got 450,000 people today. You know, so that we're human beings, you know. And so that people would then try, you know, to move on and go and look for better opportunities for themselves, for their families, and so forth. I think humanely, it's quite understandable. So, at least, as I said, for the Somalis, the status cannot be in question. The whole question of mixed migration is, again, one of the key issues, you know, that we'll have to deal with in the months and in the years ahead, to try to find this balance between the rights of the refugees and the rights of the migrants and the interests of the state and of the people and what have you. It's a complex issue, again, looking at what others are doing, trying to do, is important. And I do encourage you or South Africa in general to see what is going on elsewhere. On the question of, yeah, they are coming because of political turmoil, and then you ask about famine, and also for famine reasons. And that's, again, one of the very difficulties. Often, it is difficult to distinguish, you know, the main reason for the movement. Because they intertwine somehow. They go together. It's clear that why do we have famine? It's probably because of the overall political situation, the total disruption, you know, of life in the country. Because, you know, as is often said, that famine is not just a function of the climatic condition. It's also basically the way a country has managed, you know, food security and all the like. And to strike an analogy, this is not the first time the issue arises under that light. Remember the 80s. 1984, when we had 83-84, the famine in Ethiopia. We had this huge famine crisis, which was described as a famine, but was a political connotation as well. I mean, this was the time you had the Mengistu regime and then fighting against the Eritrea and, you know, ETLF, freedom fighters, and so forth. So the conflict, you know, opened the door, you know, to a famine. In other words, lack of appropriate measure to foresee what was coming, to take preventive measures or mitigating measures, and so forth. So distinguishing both, you know, distinguishing between the political reasons, reasons related to conflict and famine, and so forth, is a bit difficult. That's what I would say to start with. Now, if we want to be very, very now, strictly speaking, it is true that a person who leaves a country because of famine, earthquake, and what have you, does not qualify for refugee status. that's clear, because we go back to the definition, you know, that is not, the definition is clear, I mean, it's there, you know. Event series in public order, disturbing public order, it is conflict, war, breakdown, total breakdown of law and order. Okay. That's the strict interpretation. But again, it could evolve. Let me just refer then to the OAU, to the AU Convention of 2009, Kampala. That is a convention which, when addressing the issue of internal displacement, does not make a distinction between man-made disaster, conflict, war, and so on, and natural disaster. It basically envisages both situations as deserving setting up a legal regime. So that's, I think, it would be difficult. Faced with a person, often a person would tell you, and that's why doing this eligibility is sometimes is a very difficult exercise at times, because you may have a person coming and say, you know, why did you come? Okay, because of famine. And then you would just stop at that, okay, you're not a refugee. But if you dig a little bit and go in deeper, you know, why, how come, you know, there's famine, or how come you lacked food and so forth, then you may start hearing of other things about the inability to access the relief center, for example, where food was distributed because of the conflict. You know, bombs were falling and we could not move out and, you know, we could not cultivate our crop. And, you know, and then you're moving into the politics of things. You're moving into political consideration. Relocation of reception centers close to the border. Again, I think we're at a very early stage, so I would refrain from really saying too much. Let's see what plan is put on the table. That's our hope. Let's see what plan is put on the table. If the idea is that you would put reception centers close to the border, and I, as I had heard, it been elaborated or referred to at some stage, and you would basically attempt to confine people in the border area, and then you make a decision, and those who are accepted, you let them in, those who are refused, you take them back. Again, let's see how what plan is developed, because let's face it, I mean, confining people goes with challenges. What do? You set up the Hong Kong type of camps that we saw in the 80s, the closed camp with barbed wire, and try to prevent people from exiting the center. It doesn't work. It won't work. You have all sorts of problems. What about the relief? How are you going to organize, you know, assistance? Food, medical assistance, and so on. How long will you be keeping people for? As I said, for me, I wait to see what comes. There is a plan. I wish we were consulted. If we could be consulted, then what we would do, we would share the information that we have. We would share the information that we have as to what happened in several places where those centers were set up. Because there are countries which indeed have gone through that route. I don't think they've necessarily been successful. But again, I'm not going to pronounce myself, because again, it's the prerogative of the state after all to try to devise systems and methods of dealing with these issues. Let us just hope that everything is done, you know, that the whoever is working on that is well informed about the different aspects of this relocation. Because there are many issues which may arise. Well, I hope that new legislation will not revert. Well, yeah, I think isn't that a legitimate concern? I mean, frankly, we are starting off, as I said, with excellent legislation. Right? Now, which means that Could it still be improved? Yes, probably there could still be improvement here and there. But basically, generally speaking, when you compare, you know, the legal system as it pertains to refugees in South Africa to, you know, others, it is one of the best. So obviously, for me, when I hear reform, and when I hear reform against the background of challenges and failed implementation and abuses and so forth, obviously, I would expect reform to result in less guarantees, you know, and in a less liberal approach to the issue. That's why we have to watch, you know, and carefully and draw attention, you know, to some of the things. If you feel that the image of the country may suffer by, you know, somehow going backward instead of moving forward on the issue. And that's all. That's I would say. The question of training, is it disturbing? I mean, there are less training, let's face it. That's the reality. We did many more trainings in 2009 than we did in 2010 and 2011. And as I said, that we cannot go again and pose ourselves and say we are going to train your officials. I mean, we sit down, we agree on a training plan and the program and so forth. If we reach an agreement, we go and implement the agreement. If, you know, there is, we hear that no, it's not necessary, we rather have it through, you know, wait until the academy starts functioning really and so forth. Well, we just have to accept. But we definitely feel that training is very important. The training is extremely important because we all know the difficulties that the officers who are dealing with these issues of status determination are confronted with. It's a difficult exercise. Everybody acknowledges that. I mean, everywhere, not here, only even in the United States, in those places where they, you know, they have highly trained individuals even, you know, dealing with this matter. It is complex. It's, you know, it's not easy. So the more training there are, the better. And then we do hope that there's more receptivity in the effort. But, it could happen. I mean, I don't want to sound pessimistic here. It is true that maybe something has been put in place at the level of the academy, and that, you know, once it starts really running and functioning, we will be called upon to support. And we definitely are prepared to support the authorities in that regard. Honorable Sela, I'm not able to put the right pronunciation, I'm sorry for that. Need for more awareness, certainly need for more awareness. And frankly, here, if you could help, you know, you as the representatives of the people, obviously it would be important. And everyone has a role to play in this awareness. What is UNHCR doing? I think I alluded a bit to what we do. It's not substantive. I mean, yes, there are initiatives which are taken. It's not only us. I mean, there are also some non-government organizations which does, and even the IOM, the International Organization of Migration, also does have some initiatives. But again, it should really be at a higher level. There should be more, a more organized campaign, ideally, you know, again, with a group strong involvement of government. Not only at the national level, even at the provincial level, you know, and the municipality. And there are some municipalities which are doing, you know, at least shown an interest in going along that path. In Johannesburg, for example, the city has a migrant desk, for example, which is, you know, certainly useful. The mayor, you know, convened meetings of a body that has been set up, which allows exchange of views between the migrant communities, you know, and the officials and the representatives of people in Joburg. It is something that certainly, you know, could be emulated elsewhere. I mean, last time I met Mrs. Delil, I suggested to her if this could be replicated in Cape Town, for example. You know, that certainly would be useful. The more interaction there are, the better. The more people know about the conditions of the foreigners, the better, obviously. Yeah, when you say, well, if you move, you ask me the reason why we would move a refugee to a third country, and resettlement. Yeah, but that would be because we would conclude that the person's stay in a given place is not really tenable. Concretely, in case of South Africa, for example, we have had some of these of Mali refugees who have been attacked 2, 3, 4 times. And of course they're traumatized. And then if they come to you and say, listen, you want me to stay here to look and integrate, look at what has happened to me. And then, you know, sometimes very graphic, and they would remove their shirt and show you where the person was stabbed and what have you. If there is a possibility of submitting that claim, the application for a resettlement, we do it. We do it. It's for humanitarian reasons, often. And it's our criteria, and we have some criteria that we try to follow. And the primary one, of course, is being security related. By so doing, we are not passing a judgment on the country, on the state. Let us be very clear on that. The fact that we resettle or we make submission from all sorts of countries, because we feel our primary focus is the individual. And we limit it at that. We feel that an individual, the prospects for living in safety and psychologically also being all right, is not there. Except we resettle people sometimes for medical reasons. Like for example, a few months ago we were able to have in Norway, if I'm not mistaken, to accept a person. A refugee was in Botswana and needed dialysis and could not get it, so now we accepted to take that person. And so it would be for medical reasons as well. Again, unfortunately, only very, very few people benefit for that kind of very targeted measure. I know it was an issue, by the way. I mean, I'm glad you raised it, because in 2008, as the debate was raging here about what do you do with all these people who have been displaced, who have been attacked, of course some people were arguing that they should all be resettled, okay? And then, you like it or not, the vibes that you were getting from government circles, they were wondering how would that be perceived. If in theory, this is theoretical, because realistically it could not happen, but if theoretically we had been able to resettle all the foreign or the refugees who were here elsewhere, obviously there would have been some interpretation of that. Okay. So again, for us as an organization, we always have to be careful of maintaining a balance and not opening the door for undue criticism of governments which are, with all the difficulties and mistakes that can come, and at least trying to do the right thing and trying to address issues, as you can imagine. Because what my personal concern was that we should not endanger the institution of asylum. Because if resettling, say, 5,000 people would have led the South African government to say, okay, good, you took 5,000, why don't you take the 50,000? And then we are done with the issue of refugees in this country. That would not have been accepted. So I hope you understand where I'm coming from here. Because you still, it's not one crisis which would, lead you to throw, what the expression, the baby with the water. this is the issue, because at the end of the day, you still have to make sure the institution of asylum is preserved, that the country remains committed to accepting people who subsequently may knock at its door and seek admission. So these are things that we have to reflect on and think as we make our decision. But again, to sum up, at the end of the day, everything being equal, we look at the individual and we try to assist the individual who may have the problem. UNHCR increase our position with security in North Africa. Well, here, you don't want me to start talking politics, surely. And as an organization, obviously, we are very active and have been very active in North Africa, and trying to deal with the displacement that has resulted from Tunisia crisis did not, it led to some movement, of course the Libyan one which has produced quite a number of people moving across to Tunisia, to Egypt and so forth. We are humanitarian organizations. We are often accused of that. I mean, we come after the fact very often. Although as an organization we also try to do preventive work, and we try to be participate in the various initiatives which are aimed at preventing crises from occurring and population displacement and so forth. But this being said, by and large, we are still an organization which comes in once, you know, there has been a crisis and people have been displaced, and we try to address the humanitarian issue and that find the humanitarian response. This is what we have done in relation to North Africa with people who have been displaced, you know, and then we hope that of course they will be able to return home. I do not think there will be really an impact on the situation in South Africa. And I may be correct, you may have a different view on that, but you think it will impact in South Africa? Unless you are thinking of some prominent people who may be coming here seeking asylum? I don't know. and I don't know whether the proceedings are the protocol here.
I'm not sure, Mr. Kennedy, if Honourable Marcella wanted to maybe make a follow up on that.
No, well, Chair, the issue of migration and, of course, the impact of any instability that may occur anywhere in the region or the continent thereof, it becomes inevitable to any country not to start planning or to position itself, especially if you're a country like South Africa, wherein in the SADC region itself, we're the main recipient of such persons. So one has got to be mindful of any eventuality, really. So all I was trying to ascertain on your side is whether or not there is anything to worry about, and obviously what is your view on that. So it was merely on the perception and obviously your own preparedness should that be the case. You tried to respond to it earlier, but not to the point that which I've raised.
So I understand. You know, very valid point. It is true that Libya is a country which had a fairly large number of foreign nationals, you know, mostly workers from Mali, Senegal, I mean, you know, you name it, and Sudan and so forth. And then, of course, I can understand your fear or concern that as a result of the crisis there, some of those people, or many of these people, would look for another place where to go. And but the question would be, are we then going to be talking about refugees or of migrants? That's going to be really the distinction to be made. I mean, I suspect that the majority, if they were, you know, to come down here, would still be migrants and would need to be dealt with under a migration regime. But it's a valid point. It's obvious that a crisis in a given country, no matter what, may have an impact on the situation in Southern Africa. We had feared that, to be very frank, but so far we have not seen any increase of people coming from North Africa, in South Africa. I suspect if I was sitting in Sudan or in the Gulf states, probably I would look at things differently, because I presume, given the proximity, probably the movement would take place, you know, towards the Gulf states or, you know, down close to the neighboring countries, as opposed to Southern Africa, which is, after all, quite far. All right. Then, Honorable McIntosh, okay. UNHCR is little government within the government. No, we are not a little government within the government, certainly not. As I indicated during the presentation, government is the driving seat when it comes to the protection of people in the territory, including refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, and so forth. Our role is to support government action. Okay. And in that connection, if we feel and assist government in fulfilling its international obligations and commitments. And we try to do it to the best of our ability with means which sometimes are not commensurate to what we would like to do. And at the extreme, we feel that government is here, that has really gone wrong, you know, we have the possibility of launching into condemnation and so forth, which we try to avoid, because frankly we believe that constructive engagement should always be taking place, because at the end of the day you have to maintain a relationship. So we certainly we don't consider ourselves a little government with the government. We don't have the means of a government, particularly in a place like South Africa. Do we keep records of refugees, fingerprints and so forth? No. In the case of South Africa, as you may know, it is the Department of Home Affairs which is contacted by asylum seekers. Asylum seekers, when they arrive in South Africa, don't come to UNHCR. They go to the department. That's why they go. That's why they are fingerprinted. That's why the record is kept. We do see some of them, and we do see some refugees when they feel that we could address a problem or assist them. They do approach us. You know, we have twice a week, for example, reception days where people can come to our office. They can also go to our partners, the various institutions that you saw on the list. They can approach them as well to expose their problems and seek assistance and so forth. Then on those occasions we keep a record, we take notes and information on the individuals, but we do not maintain a database of all the refugees or asylum seekers who are in South Africa, because we are not the organ to be approached. Again, that goes back basically to the fact that what we are talking about here, the whole institution of asylum, of refugee management and so forth, is governed by international treaties, international conventions, and states ratify the convention. We have our mandate, we have a statute and so forth, which gives us responsibility to fulfill, but at the end of the day, it is the state which has ratified and has got obligation, and that's why, for example, we do recommend that refugee status determination is carried out by state organs, like here with the Department of Home Affairs. It's not the case everywhere. There are places where we do, particularly countries which have not ratified the convention, then we do the eligibility ourselves, which is very difficult. But that is when countries have not ratified the convention. And even in some countries which have ratified the convention, they do ask us to assist them in reviewing the application for status and but really our call is that once a country has ratified a convention, has taken up some international obligation, it has got to domesticate those obligations through the Refugee Act and so forth, and then basically put in place the whole system which goes with it in terms of determining who is a refugee, issuing the appropriate document to the people and so forth, and protecting, generally speaking.
Jake, I just have a follow-up on that. If that is your policy, why then, if there's a convention and there's an agreement, and in a sense you deal with government, why do you fund advocacy groups?
Well, let me get on that one. We fund advocacy groups because they advocate for the rights of the refugees. You mentioned Nelson Mandela for university. You mentioned Nelson Mandela University, for example. No, we signed an agreement with them last year. Why? Simply because we realized that we were pretty much absent in Port Elizabeth. Whereas we have an office in Pretoria ourselves, and we were working with partners, Lawyers for Human Rights, both in Durban. They have an office in Durban, which we fund. They have an office in Johannesburg, they have one in Pretoria, Here in Cape Town, we have the University of Cape Town, UCT, you know, which is there. We realized that in Port Elizabeth, we had nobody. And there were a number of incidents involving Somalis, difficulties to access documents, you know, the asylum system, and so forth. So we decided, you know, to enter into an agreement with Nelson Mandela University, which had a small section which was doing some pro-deo work for refugees. They had a couple of lawyers, you know, assisting migrants in general, destitute people. So we did enter into an agreement with them so that they can have a specific involvement with regard to asylum seekers and refugees. So it is, frankly, not interfering with anything at all. The same way Lawyers for Human Rights, for example. These are basically among those agencies, we distinguish between the partners who deal with social issues, you know, questions of assistance, you know, somebody doesn't have accommodation, be kicked out of their house because could not pay rent, the agency would pay, you know, support 2-3 months rent and, you know, and all those things, the social and the legal. But the legal agencies are extremely important for us because these are the agencies which assist asylum seekers, for example, vis-à-vis the Department of Home Affairs. You know, if they are unable to accept the department and put in an application, they would write to the Department of Home Affairs and expose the case. On appeal matters, for example, when a case has been rejected, they assist the asylum seekers in the appeal, you know, vis-à-vis the board. Now it's going to be the asylum appeals authority, as it would be the case now. If there is an incident involving an asylum seeker or refugee who gets, for example, beaten up or assaulted, and then the person does not have the possibility or has difficulties approaching the police to file a case, doesn't have language, is scared, that Lawyers for Human Rights would have somebody accompany that person to the police station and file. I think it is good. It has nothing to do with interfering, you know, at all. And even on advocacy, again, as I said, advocacy, let us not misconstrue what advocacy is all about. It is not that they would advocate out of the blue. They're advocating about rights, you know, which are enshrined in the various legal instruments that exist. And in fact, I wish, you know, there were more resources. There was more resources, you know, put at the disposal of this organization. Because at the end of the day, we all gain. Government gains as well. Because, I mean, frankly, all these actions are geared toward one objective: to ensure that the state fulfills its obligation. And if it does, everybody is happy. The country gets a good image. And as a defender of human rights, of rights of migrants, of refugees, and so forth, I think it's in everybody's interest, you know, to have that those organizations playing that role. And that's all I would say. I think I finished. You had also asked about where do we survey the reasons why people do come? I think I believe I have answered by saying that people do not, we are not the organization that is approached first. It's indeed the department. Now, of course, we are in touch with the community, you know, we see, we talk to them, so we have a fairly good idea as to why people are coming into South Africa. And in a nutshell, we believe that people do come to South Africa either because they have indeed refugee-related concerns, because they flee persecution, they flee violence, and so forth, and others do come because of economic consideration. So the challenge is to distinguish who is who. And even in situations that, you know, are described as just producing economic migrants, like Zimbabwe, for example, we challenge that. We know very well there are Zimbabweans who are coming here because they need protection. I mean, 2 weeks ago, my attention was drawn to the case of a young man who used to be with the police and was accused of having joined MDC, the opposition party, spent four years in jail and managed to escape, actually, a few months ago, and he ended up in South Africa. So, clearly a refugee, no doubt about it. So we have cases like that. We have cases of teachers, we have cases of trade people, working trade union, and so forth, who do qualify for refugee status and welcome. Certainly. Okay, I think I've covered the questions.
More than Mozambique.
Yeah. Could you perhaps retell about Mozambique?
Yeah, but on your statistics, there's no mention of Mozambicans, but they're a very large migrant, if we use the group.
Probably migrants, yes. They're not. I mean, Mozambique, as far as we are concerned, Mozambique is not a refugee producing country as such. That you may have an individual here and there claiming refugee status, that's always possible. And it could be, of course, you could have some people here and there qualifying, but that's more the exception than the rule. Mozambicans do come to South Africa to work. And I think we talk less about Mozambique and to Zimbabwe, probably because they've been for a long time now, this visa-free regime for Mozambicans to come to South Africa.
Thank you, Mr. Kibim. The honorable members, time is against us. Just to also pose a question with regard to this broad definition of what the refugee is. It does worry me at times because you will find people who have committed crimes in their original countries and then they go or hide in other countries under the disguise of persecution when the person is actually avoiding prosecution. Could you maybe comment on that one? And also, you mentioned that you were discouraging the issuing of a Zimbabwean passport to Zimbabweans, if I heard it correctly. The issuing of Zimbabwean passports to Zimbabweans. Ne? By Zimbabweans. You know, it's with regard to this Zimbabwean project. What are you advising? Would you advise that it should be South Africa that issue out such passport? And it becomes a problem as to how do you issue a passport to a person who has his or her own country? Why can't they get the passports from his or their own original countries? And the concept of statelessness. What do we mean that a person is stateless? Honorable Lavma.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. Just a few last questions. Bearing in mind that governments are actually not voted in by refugees, political parties are not voted for by refugees. It's very, very important to expect governments to actually be on the side of refugees. When you have outcries about people taking jobs, my colleague mentioned taking wives, etc., and governments who are voted for by those same people who are saying that, and not by the refugees, to expect them to speak on the right of refugees and support the right of the rights of refugees. When you say you do, for instance, I haven't heard any of the radio messages that you've had. When you say you do these outreaches, what is your message to government? And how do you, what do you say to government, what do you say to South Africans as to why they should respect the rights of refugees? This links to the grants issue, by the way. Most South Africans will not support you in extending grants to refugees. I am generalizing, but I believe that to be true. I've come under personal attack for standing up for the rights of refugees. And told that I'm here to fight for the rights of South Africans and not others. What makes South Africa attractive as an asylum destination? It is clearly attractive. What makes it attractive? Is it the fact that, that it takes up to 7 years, for instance, to finalize asylum applications, in which time people can perhaps marry South Africans, establish a life here, that people are able to work and study, etc.? What makes South Africa attractive as an asylum destination? Because it's clearly what they are, what the government is working on to change. And then lastly, Chairperson, when Deputy Minister Chohan addressed this committee a couple of months ago, she referred, I found disturbingly, it might not have been intended to be so, but she referred to the convention being a 1951 convention drawn up shortly after the Second World War, and that when tensions were still and emotions were still running high after the Second World War and Auschwitz and the, you know, the incredible abuse of human rights that took place, and that it might need revisiting. It was her comment, not mine. Are you aware of any talk, thinking, whatever, within South Africa of withdrawing or debating participation, whatever, within the convention and the protocol? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Kavis. I think I'm in line with Mr. McIntosh with regard to the funding of all this other advocates group. It does disturb at times. But over to you for you to respond to the questions that we've just raised.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Your questions first. Criminals, you know, disguising and trying to come here to basically flee, not persecution, but prosecution. It's a legitimate concern, obviously, that, you know, you don't want criminals to be using a system which fundamentally is in place to protect victims. That's why when you look at the convention, when you look at your own legislation, criminals are excluded from refugee status. A person who has committed a crime, and here, I think last time I talked to you, I had mentioned that because we felt a little bit uneasy, although time will tell us whether our concerns are real. When you look at the convention, it clearly says that a person who has committed a serious non-political crime, okay, in the country of origin will be excluded from refugee status. The way you have brought it into your domestic legislation, as amended, in fact, here recently, 2001, is to say that you will exclude a person who has committed a crime which is not of a political nature, if committed in South Africa, would result in imprisonment without the option of a fine. Okay. Now, that formulation for us is a bit of a concern because we would have wished to still maintain the idea of serious non-political crime, which of course is open to interpretation. What is a serious non-political crime? Now, I would still, as I said, wait. You know, I mean, the jury is out as far as I'm concerned. I would like to see how that provision is actually interpreted and applied by the Department of Home Affairs. And I mean, I'm not sufficiently knowledgeable about, you know, South Africa criminal law, you know, particular sentencing and so forth. I just wonder, if a person is, for example, accused and found guilty of culpable homicide, you know, having been, you know, driving drunk and cause of death and so forth, is that an offense which is punishable with imprisonment without option of a fine, or is there possibility of a fine? Because if it was that kind of offense which is punishable by imprisonment without option of a fine, I would find it difficult that a person would be denied refugee status for that kind of offense. See what I mean? That's why the convention had kept the word serious to allow an interpretation, some flexibility, you know, to the body or the organ which is reviewing the application. Because then you determine yourself what is serious. What I'm referring to now, the accident, may not be considered serious in with regard to the application of the convention. So the change that has been introduced in the law here somehow narrows down the room for interpretation. So let us see how it's going to be implemented by the officers who are going to do determination. So again, to go back now on the issue, a criminal does not deserve to be recognized as a refugee. That is clear. Now the challenge now is to know whether you are really dealing with a criminal or not a criminal, because do not forget, you may also have trumped the charges against a person. This is a standard practice of a country which is, you know, violating people's rights, to go and claim that so and so is a criminal, he has embezzled money and so forth, whereas in reality what they are after the person for is not because of embezzlement, it's just for political reasons, because they want to have the person out of the way for the next elections. That happens as well. So, you know, so it becomes an issue of reviewing the facts of the matter, you know, and that's sometimes difficult. And our experience is that all this Interpol, you know, warrant of arrest and so forth, sometimes need to be taken with a pinch of salt, because there may be trumpeted charges to discredit an individual who is a genuine refugee, who meets the criteria, but then the government will try to present matters differently. But this being set aside, clearly again, a refugee is not, a criminal is not a refugee. Now, on the Zimbabwe, on the Zimbabwe ID, maybe I did not make myself clear enough. What I was saying really is that, you know, the way the project was devised and implemented, you know, implies that to receive the permit, a Zimbabwe national had to produce a passport, a Zimbabwean passport. Okay. Now, obviously, only the Zimbabwean authorities can issue a Zimbabwean passport. So I'm not saying that South Africa should have issued a Zimbabwean passport. This is a non-starter. However, what I would have hoped, again, as I said, I think I was a bit careful the way I presented that. I started by, you know, having a disclaimer of some sort, I think I do not know whether there was something different which could have been done. You know, would it have been possible for the permit to be issued without people producing a passport? One has to go into the Immigration Act. Was there a possibility, perhaps, of government to submit to you, the Honourable Members of Parliament, a piece of legislation which would have allowed the permit to be issued without having to produce a Zimbabwean passport? Maybe, maybe not, I cannot tell. But the problem with that project is that by asking a Zimbabwean passport, you were making the success of the operation pretty much dependent on the production of that passport. And that is something which could be, is problematic, because as a state you take an initiative, you know, a very valuable, you know, commendable initiative, I would like to see you maintaining control of the whole process and not having it pretty much dependent on the act or the omission of another government. Do you see what I mean? Now, I think, in all fairness now to Minister Zuma, I think it's a concern that she had also, because as you probably know, at some stage, what I understand is that she debated whether or not South Africa would fund the issuance of those passports. And I believe there were discussions, and I think there was no agreement on the cost, because what I understand is that South Africa wanted to pay what South Africans do pay for a passport, whereas Zimbabwe asks much more than the South Africans. So they could not reach an agreement, and therefore the government of South Africa basically backtracked and said, okay, we are not going to get into this. But the issue was discussed. So that shows, obviously, that there was a concern that, you know, the obtention of the Zimbabwe passport could cause problems for the success of the operation. And again, let's wait to see, and I hope it's going to be made public, the report, you know, on the exercise, whether this is something which is highlighted as a major consideration in the success or failure or, you know, concerned about the whole project. But yeah, clearly, don't have, when you take an initiative, control it yourself. Don't rely on another country to come up, you know, would expect the other country to come up, because it may, because here we followed a little bit, I mean, this issue, because as I said, we have an interest on all these issues, even if it's not necessarily refugee related. I mean, it is clear that we got reports of delays in issues of documents, people being denied the document, and the cost being prohibitive. It was 750 rand, I think, at some stage at the beginning. It went down a little bit. I mean, the booklet's not been ready. And IOM tried to assist with the mobile issuing the vans in Musina to issue that to the farm workers. There were all sorts of challenges around the issuance of the Zimbabwean passport, which impacted clearly on the success, on the number of people who could access the dispensation permit. I don't know enough about the actual working of the system, but I mean, I referred earlier on to this Article 31.2b of the Immigration Act, which allows, it's an exception, the exemption that which allows the minister. I don't know whether in that particular case, for example, you need a passport, and I don't think you need it, because you remember in 2008, there was a project which resulted in the displaced people being issued with a card under the Immigration Act, for a card for 6 months. It was under this Article 31.2b. For people who had lost their documents and so forth, they were issued with that card, which was a temporary permit of some sort, but they did not have to produce any passport. So this is really what I meant by that. On the statelessness, yes, I mean, a stateless person is an individual who is unable to prove his or her nationality, that he or she is a national of a country. It happens. We have a brochure that we gave you, and you see how it works. It's an issue which is real, but not necessarily very much documented. It happens in some circumstances. A clear-cut one is when you have, for example, the Soviet Union. When with the break of the Soviet Union, you had a number of people who were not able to claim the nationality or citizenship of the new republic, Ukraine, Belarusia, and so forth, and at the same time had lost the Soviet Union citizenship, which no longer existed. So then you find people who could be at risk of statelessness. Now, we did work a lot, the organization, we did work a lot with these former Soviet Union states, to Lithuania, Belarusia, and so forth, around that issue, to make sure that the new states, which came out of the breakup of the Soviet Union, then started giving, recognizing the citizenship of their people. Because, I mean, let us also look at the background. I mean, with the population transfers which had been taking place at the Soviet Union and so forth. So there is that possibility. Now, to bring the issue closer to home, okay, in Southern Africa, we think that the country which is going to be causing us problem, or at least where the issue arises most starkly, is Zimbabwe. You know, Zimbabwe is a country which had received quite a number of people coming from outside Rhodesia at the time, southern Rhodesia. You know, you had at independence in 1981 in Zimbabwe, Malawi, and people who had moved into southern Rhodesia from Malawi, from Zambia, from all places. Now, without going into the details, what I understand is that in 1981, basically, the constitution of 1981 provided that all those people who were born in Zimbabwe were Zimbabwe nationals, irrespective of where the parents came from and what have you. But then subsequently there were some legal changes which were introduced in 1983, and then most lately in 2002, if I'm not mistaken, which implied first of all that there could not be dual citizenship anymore, and that people had to opt for Zimbabwe nationality if they wanted to, or even apply for Zimbabwean citizenship. And they are clear, it's clear that some people will not be able to do so because they just do not have the right documents to support the application. And in the case of Zimbabwe, there's another factor, you know, and we can, I think, talk openly, although, as I said earlier, we are not into politics. The group which we believe is going to be most affected, who has been most affected, are the farm workers. Many of the farm workers who were working with those farms which have been seized, through what we know, right, and which were perceived as being MDC supporters and so forth, are finding themselves today without Zimbabwean passport, unable to claim Zimbabwean passport, to be recognized as Zimbabwean. And at the same time, without links to Malawi, Mozambique, and what else, you have that. Another country which has the problem, and I would say is more open about it, is Mozambique. But in the case of Mozambique, it has got less to do with changes in the legislation and, to a certain extent, politics. It has more to do with lack of capacity to register its nationals, birth certificates not being issued, documents, registers not being properly kept, and so forth. So you do have, even in South Africa, as you speak today, a number of Mozambican nationals who have no papers, basically. And as I said, they are being more respected because we launched about a few weeks ago a project, UNHCR and the Mozambican government, which would lead to the documentation of Mozambicans by their consulate in Maseru. The project was launched in Maseru. So they have teams now of Mozambican officials who are going around and organizing meetings of people of Mozambican origin who are undocumented. And if they can produce whatever they have, a piece of paper, or have a witness who certify that so-and-so came from Mozambique, then they are issuing the Mozambican identity card to those people. Thus, not making them stateless. But if this was not to take place, there is a risk of having these people unable to prove their citizenship. So it is a real issue. I do hope that in the case of South Africa, it is not serious, although we have also a small project with Lawyers for Human Rights, which is also looking into the issue whether in South Africa you may also have some individuals, for reasons that we know. Prior to 1994, was it that easy to get birth certificates and so forth? Probably not. So we may also have people who are certainly South Africans, but who are not able to prove it. It's a general problem of documentation. So there is a possibility. If you wish, I could leave you also with a document on the issue, the background paper that was prepared for a conference that we held, in fact, last week in Esport with representatives of different governments on the issue of statelessness. So it's a study on statelessness issue or potential for statelessness problems in Southern Africa. So I could share it with you and the members of the committee, because it's an issue which will come up definitely in the future. Honorable Love More, difficulty to have government on the side of refugees. Okay, message to government. Our message, by the way, is not really for government. Our message is for the people. And it's a message, as you can imagine, of tolerance. Ubuntu. A message of coexistence. That's really the message that we are putting across. Now, why should it be difficult to have government on the side of refugees? I don't think it's necessarily a given. We do have governments which realize the importance of supporting and assisting victims of violence and persecution. Governments which act with humanity. Because, at the end of the day, this is what we are talking about. The institution of asylum is not a new institution. It has been there for centuries in all regions, all religions, so forth. So it is not unheard of or exceptional that governments would be supporting victims of violence, victims of persecution. Now, I agree with you that these days, with economic crisis, pressure on services and what have you, it is often not popular to be defending refugees. That is the fact. But that should not deter us for advocating for their defense. Obviously, in the discourse, one has to be careful not to offend by taking side of refugees and ignoring completely the needs of the vulnerable among the population. So that would lead to xenophobia, that would lead to rejection and so forth. But at the end of the day, frankly, I think government or the authorities, I don't want to say the government because it's the executive, I would say you are involved as well. You have a leadership role to play and explain the misconceptions that exist, because a lot of the things that are said about refugees taking jobs and this are not necessarily true. Refugees do contribute to the economy. The refugees do bring very positive contributions to the cultural life and whatever. I mean, I think the case, refugees and migrants in general, I think there's been quite a lot of documentation around that. One has to, should not have this narrow view of foreigners cause problems and that's the end of the story. I mean, they don't bring anything. That is certainly not the case. But I agree with you that if you were today to have a vote on as to whether we should admit refugees and foreigners, you probably would lose. But not only in South Africa, everywhere. Everywhere. I know it's just a human reaction to feel that the others can only be a threat to you, and if it would not come, there would be jobs and there would be nice houses and so forth. It's a general feeling that people have, but I think they're misinformed. So the role, I believe, of government, of the leadership and so forth, is to explain, to put the facts on the table, and to show that migration has got very positive, makes a very positive contribution. I mean, we need to go and start talking about the United States and all those countries which were actually made by migrants. Certainly not. But yeah, I agree the issue is not popular, but that should not deter one from advocating for the human approach, for humanitarian views on the issue. And ultimately, in the cases of those countries which have ratified the international convention, for the respect of international obligations that the country has subscribed to. Most South Africans would not support the grants for refugees, probably. But I mean, most the French would not support, do not support that the beautiful social security system benefits refugees either, or foreigners. That's the name of the game. This is how it happens everywhere. But this being said, I think if the law allows refugees to obtain grants, because they are here lawfully, they have been accepted into the country, they have to integrate, and if they face difficulties, there is provision for them to benefit. I think one is to let them benefit from those advantages or system which have been put in place. I agree. I mean, the issue of, it's not just refugee, of foreigners in general is not popular, let's face it. But then it takes, I think, courage, integrity from the leadership to articulate these issues using facts and to confront public opinion. Sometimes public opinion should not be the guiding factor in decision-making, as we all know. Take the death penalty, for example. Go and do a survey, take a vote. Obviously, people would vote for death penalty. But is that a good reason for then maintaining it when it exists or reinstating it when it can be? No. I think leadership is what really is needed to advance some of these issues in societies, in spite of public opinion. And that's what I would say. What makes South Africa attractive? Well, you know the answer better than I do. South Africa is attractive because the economy of South Africa Here I'm talking about migration in general. I mean, it's certainly not comparable to the others. You know, just an anecdote. I mean, the other day I was talking to a lady from DRC, and I was asking her, why did you come here? You know, you're suffering that problem. So he said, Mr. Kimbim, let me tell you one thing. In Kinshasa, every year, my two kids had to suffer bouts of malaria twice a year. Since I've been here, no malaria for them. And this is something, as a mother, which I'm really grateful about. Because whenever they suffer these bouts of malaria, I fear they would die. So it's just an anecdote. It just tells you what makes a country attractive to people. It's what it has got to offer. That is on general migration issues. Now, when it comes to the refugees, what makes South Africa attractive for people who meet criteria for recognition, refugees who are fleeing persecution and so forth, I think it's primarily the freedom of movement that has been recognized to them. The fact that they could move freely, that they can seek employment, that they can take their kids to school anywhere in the country, and that they do not need to stay in the camp. That is, now does that mean one should revisit that? I would not think so. On the contrary, our advocacy is that the other countries must also adopt the same position, make also movement free for people, refugees who are in your territory. So I think that's probably what makes the country attractive. Now, some people probably bank, but I mean that's marginal. I think those who are banking on the defective working of the system, which would allow them to stay as asylum seekers for 7 years and so forth, even those ones, I mean the reason why they're coming here is really because they feel that this is a place where they can seek employment and whatever. So I would say here the response would really be, the way forward should be, let's make all those countries of asylum as attractive as possible, starting with that crucial issue of freedom of movement, which we are having next month in Geneva, a celebration of the 60th anniversary of the 1951 convention, and also of the 1961 convention on the reduction of statelessness. So there's going to be a big meeting with a ministerial level where we expect countries to come and make a pledge as to one or two things that they will change their system. And what we have been in this region, and like in others, really, calling on governments to do is to make a pledge to revisit these reservations that they made to Article 26 of the Convention on the Freedom of Movement, so that that doesn't apply anymore. Will public opinion be happy? Probably not. We realize it, certain, but it's the right thing to do. In today's world, where people move from rural areas to urbanized areas, urbanization is a phenomenon, and also being able to move freely increases the chances of local integration, increases the chance of securing employment, engaging in some activities, and so forth. Last. Question was about the deputy. Revisiting the 1951 convention. Let me be very frank. We are resisting that at Tunisia. We do not want the 1951 convention to be revisited. You know why? Because we fear that if it is revisited, it's going to lead to a lowering of the standard. That's a reality. Let me be very honest about it. With the way things have evolved in the world, and the crisis and whatever. If you revisit that, the outcome will be a less protective regime. It will be a less protective regime. So we certainly would not encourage that. Now, we realize that there are problems here and there, but they should be dealt with as best as we can. We should try to move forward than going backwards and adopting restrictive regimes which would prevent people from entering and them being locked up where they apply for asylum and all those very negative measures that are sometimes are adopted to keep people away from the borders. So no, I'm not aware of any debate of that kind in South Africa. I am aware of the issue being discussed and brought here and there. I mean, it had been put on the table. I mean, there have been places or instances where people have questioned or wondered whether the old thing should not be revisited, the old regime should not be looked at again. But as I said, in terms of South Africa, I have not heard. It's the first time I hear the Deputy Minister bring it up. It would not, of course, be a unilateral initiative. You know, this is something which would require consultation, concerted position of states and so forth. But we would certainly not encourage it. We would not encourage it because we don't think it would lead. You know, it would not solve any problem. On the contrary, it would make a regime more restrictive. Whereas we need an open regime. We need a liberal regime to deal with what is clearly a humanitarian and human rights issue, that is of refugees. Finally, Madam Chair, your advocacy you please again. This, you see, I can somehow sympathize because, I mean, as an organization or personally, I also have been criticized so often by friends from the NGO community, particularly in 2008, where a group of them, as you may know or not know, called for an inquiry into my action as the leader of the operation in South Africa, in handling the xenophobia crisis, where the accusation was that you just sided with government and did not protect refugees' rights and God knows what. So that happens. That happens. I think the NGO community, the advocacy group, I mean, are in their role when they raise those issues. I think we have to accept that. I think they're in good faith. They believe in the issues that they raise. I don't think we should be fearful of that, because their role is important, and there are things that we certainly miss, and then we are sometimes reminded about that, and it allows us to improve. And I think it is to the credit of South African society in general to have such a strong NGO community, civil society community, so vocal, which is, I think, it's very positive. The whole idea of check and balance is important in society. So the only, of course, what we should expect them also is to act responsibly, not to go on about undue criticism based on non-facts and things like that. That's legitimate, obviously. But as long as an organization researches an issue, takes a position, why not look into it? I'm not saying that we should necessarily agree, but I think looking into it doesn't harm, frankly. That's what I would say. I definitely am for their very, very strong involvement and support. And whatever support could be given to them, I think it would be welcome. Here we talk about the NGO community. It could also be the media and then other institutions of that kind who observe, analyze, criticize, suggest. This is perhaps the last thing I would say. What we would expect them, of course, all those bodies and organizations to engage into constructive criticism and not just negate whatever has been done, but on the contrary, to be positive and so as to have issues move forward. That's all I would say. Thank you.
Thank you, and your team. Thank you for the information that you shared with us today in enlightening us with the matters of refugees and immigration. Honorable members, I'm sure we've come to the end of our meeting. And there is a document that is circulating. We were thinking that this one, before that one, it's an invitation by FPB to a cinema to to view a film or something. But that will be on Monday the 28th, the date on which we will be maybe on oversight in Mpumalanga or KZN. So I'm not sure if we will be able to go to that viewing of the video. It's going to be impossible for us to do that. That's number one. Number two, for next week, we have reports of the portfolio committee, and I'm sure all of us have received them. So I would suggest the members to sleep over them so that next week when we meet, we go through them, correct, add, subtract, and adopt next week Tuesday. I'm sure it will be the last Tuesday of the portfolio committee for the year. If there's anything else, if there isn't anything else that we need to discuss, I would again want to thank Mr. Kibimbi and his team, and hope that every time we scream, you will always be there for us.
On the invite, sir.
Okay.
I want to also go for lunch now. Sir, the invitation says we must RSVP to the Anglican Church, and we are invited by FPB. What a coincidence, sir. Okay. So I'd love to appreciate that FPB is now a church. The other one is that we are intending to attend, but how are we going to arrange the transport to get there, or should individual members make their own way there? What if you don't even know where Calvary Square is? You've never seen it, which is going to be the first time.
That is why I brought it here, so that we discuss this, because on Monday, that Monday, we will be in Mpumalanga, if not KZN. Mm. So I was telling Eddie that it's going to be impossible to make arrangements for people to go and view that when we will be in KZN. It will be a bit costly. So I think those who may be interested, then we will have to use your resources to go and view that, and then after your view, then you can fly to wherever we will be on that day.
The oversight visit, when will we have confirmation of the details, dates, etc. of the oversight visit?
I'm sure the secretariat are still working on that. Immediately when they have information, they will circulate it to the members. Yeah, it will be soon. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, Mr. Kibimbi.